starts now.
Sisters, working class heroes, this is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, going to talk about voting. Voting made easy in Pennsylvania? Say it's not so. Maybe. We'll wait and see. Also going to talk about the prevailing wage bill pushed out of the committee yesterday, what that's going to mean for our community, what it's going to mean for workers. Just another piece of that assault on the working class of this country. Also, the hysteria continues. Obamacare is coming! Obamacare is coming! Oh, it's the end! It's the end of work. It's the end of the world. No more full-time jobs. And is that a good thing? Also going to talk about guns. The NRA won again. Congratulations, NRA. The money, the power, the money. It's the money. Shot down the Toomey Mansion bill, or the Toomey Mansion amendment. So we'll see where this goes. President not happy. Anyway, going to take your calls tonight. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So, socialist, wild, rabid socialist. That's what Obama is. In fact, anti-business. Hates business. Mitch McConnell was speaking at the American Bankers Association annual summit. And where else would you want the Senate minority to be today? Where else would you expect him to be but standing in front of a group of very wealthy bankers saying, hey, how do we get regulations to benefit us, the banks, so the next time we screw things up, you'll come and bail us out. Come and bail us out again. How can we do that? And how much money can we give you, Mr. Speaker, to come and speak to us? How much? I wonder what the payday for that was. But anyway, McConnell was speaking to the group of bankers. And, you know, he said, look, you know, the White House has a mindset. Has a mindset that says if you're making a profit, you're up to no good. You must be mistreating somebody. And I don't think anybody's saying that. I don't think anyone's saying that if you're making a profit, that you're exploiting or cheating or doing anything. I think what's being said is you look at the amount of profit. Now, understand, you have right now the highest profit margins in the history of the country. The highest profit margins and also the lowest percentage of wages to GDP also. So you have this massive gulf. There's a problem there. So to bury your head in the sand or bury your head in a banker's behind and say, well, they don't like you because you're making profit. No, we don't like you because you've destroyed our economy too many times. How many bailouts have we had in my lifetime? How many? You know, I can think of three or four off the top of my head. You go, savings and loan was huge. So you go, there's some real concern. But McConnell uses that to say, well, you know what? It's a very, very anti-business administration. This is the most, he says, the most anti-business administration since at least Jimmy Carter. And, you know, Jimmy Carter was so anti-business. He brought us a lot of deregulation. He was one of the first one to bring in the airlines, so anti-business. I would argue, wait a second. You stop and think about that deregulation thing. You think about all the trucking companies. You think about all of the airlines. Stop and think about how many times we've bailed the airlines out over the years. Stop and think about it. When they were regulated, they had to make a profit. When they were regulated, they had to have a cost structure that actually made a small profit. obviously, you couldn't pay millions and hundreds of millions of dollars out in salaries to executives. Obviously, that, you know, there was some oversight in there, saying, well, it is what it is. And guess what? You had a bunch of companies doing it. So I would think, you know, by having those rules in place that level the playing field, give people an opportunity to compete, that really is, to me, very pro-business. So when the right wing says, well, you know, they're anti-business, like Carter. No, I mean, how many trucking companies went out of business after deregulation? That to me sounds like anti-business policy, but it's the policy that the right keeps pushing. Carter was all on board with them, bought into their policy, bought into, yes, privatization and deregulation. Yes, that's where we go. So to say that Obama's the most anti-business president and since Carter, you go, wait a second. Corporate profits through the roof, CEO pay, fat and happy, workers put down and the wages suppressed. That sounds really pro-business to me. Haven't seen a piece of legislation come out that would benefit workers. Haven't seen any of that. What's he talking about? Well, it's more about divisiveness. It's more about keep the blind blind. Keep those who are running in the dark completely in the dark. And keep talking to people like, well, you know, they're the most anti-business. Yet we kind of bailed them out, right? Also talking to the bankers, McConnell said that, look, you know, we're going to use that debt limit. You're going to use the debt limit to extract more entitlement cuts. Now, they say reform. And I always love that. Reform. Whenever a Republican talks to me about reform, and most of the Democrats, whenever they talk to me about reform, it generally means I'm going to be bleeding from a certain orifice of my body. Because I look at this and you go, nothing good comes of it for me and you. The big corporations seem to do really well. Big business does really well. So to say that they're anti-business, it blows my mind. And you want to talk about something else, anti-business, since we're on the subject? Think about the Screwquester. Think about the Republicans going, yeah, hey, you gave us this bomb, we want to see it go boom. So boom, austerity bomb. Cuts coming. Lots of pain. Federal employees going to lose anywhere from 15 to 20% of their pay over the next several months. And McConnell told the bankers that there was zero chance, none, no chance, that Congress is going to go back on the Screwquester cuts. They're happening. So basically, screw you workers. He also talked about they're going to continue to block a permanent nominee for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is probably what the bankers really wanted to hear because, hey, you know, who wants somebody over their shoulder? Who wants somebody paying attention that they're ripping us off? But, you know, I've been hearing a lot about this, and you're seeing it everywhere. Obama's this grand socialist. He's a socialist. Don't you know? And I look at a couple of things. I look at the chain CPI, the fact that this is going to be the first Democratic administration. You know, the anti-business one. And I guess you can make an argument for anti-business by saying, look, if you're cutting wages and you're cutting the Social Security insurance benefits to people who need the money the most, if you're pulling money out of the economy and that hurts business, I guess you could make the argument that that's anti-business. I would say it's more anti-worker, but I guess you could make the argument. And you look at the fact that he's thrown on the table some things that I think Democrats for generations have taken as, you know what, this is who we are. This is the rock of which our foundation is built. And, you know, I'm looking at this going, this is his legacy presidency. This is what, you know, this is what he's going to be remembered by. And for me, I don't know that the reaching across saying, oh, please, is what I would want to be remembered by. Because, you know, like we talked about yesterday with the chain CPI, Judd Gregg, the former Republican governor of New Hampshire and former three-time senator, former chairman of the Senate Bank Budget Committee, also an international advisor to Goldman Sachs. He was almost giddy with the idea of going to a chain CPI. Almost giddy. Because it's going to put the thumb in the eye of those people on the left. And it's going to screw people in the future pretty sizably. In the few 20, 30 years, people like me down the road. So we're not going to see it now. So they won't have to pay the political price. But they get to say they did something. But as Greg pointed out, it's about more than just Social Security, which they're calling an entitlement. It's not an entitlement. It's an insurance program. It's what you paid into. You pay into an insurance program, you get when you need out, right? I mean, how would you like if you got into a car accident and the insurance company said, well, you know, we're having a little tough time. We're only going to give you half. How would you feel about that? Well, this is what we're talking about, letting them get away with. But Judge Gregg says, you know, this first opening salvo, this first, hey, we've cracked the door open. Social Security is on the table. And as soon as they crack the door open, we kick it off the freaking hinges, and we go after Medicare. We go after every other one of those quote-unquote entitlement programs. So we screw the people in the future. And I got to be honest, my hope is that the Democrats are not the ones who are going to screw this up for most people, for the rest of us. For me, at the end of this, it's about our insane tax code. It's about the fact that we allow these corporations and we give such huge, such wonderful tax breaks. And we talked yesterday about the report that was put out by the Government Accountability Office that says, you know, the $181 billion in tax breaks that corporations got actually equaled what they paid in taxes. So it was a zero-sum game. It was a break-even for them. What did it mean for us? Well, it meant higher property taxes, lower educational opportunities. It meant a lot of things that you and I, we just didn't get, and that our communities are struggling over. And you go across this country and you see the poverty and you see the misery and you see the pain, and it's all because we've got a one entire political party and the vast majority of the other who believes or has done nothing to create jobs. Instead, well, we got to focus on inflation, and we hear an awful lot of this. Oh, we need to fight inflation, because if inflation gets out, it would be Zimbabwe or it would be Greece. We're neither of those countries. And the fear mongers want us to believe, oh, the end is coming. You don't know how many emails I get from people saying, you know, the dollar is going to collapse. And I say, well, at some point it may. It's not going to be in the near future, but at some point it may. Because other countries want to stop dealing with us because we bully them more than anything. It's not about the strength of the dollar. Countries are borrowing more money from us than ever. You know, China wants to be the U.S. China is going to try and come up with another currency. Understand, the BRIC countries, they want to have their own, they want to compete with the U.S. They do. And they want to put us down. That's reality. It is what it is. Which is why we should be fighting for trade policies that benefit us first and foremost as a nation, not as a handful of multinational corporations who don't give a tinker's damn about this country. They care about their bottom line. We should not be so have such an inflation fetish, as we should be talking about full employment policies, get people back to work. Because then you have a growing, burgeoning economy where people got money in their pocket, people spend money, economy moves forward. Seems pretty simple to me. But yet everything I see from our friends on the radical right, and look, these are radicals, is how do we destroy education? How do we destroy the middle class? And look, when we come back, I want to talk about some of the insanity. Yesterday's bill that came out of committee to destroy prevailing wage, and also what we're doing to our education system. You know, I just saw another one of those stories from USA Today talking about the big online for-profit, these online cyber schools, and the money, mind-blowing how much money they spend on advertising. You know, the money that's supposed to go into the classroom is hanging up on the billboards and blaring out over the radio. And you wonder why our schools are struggling. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
We want the world and we're wanting it now. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the hell with.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In Erie, Pennsylvania, the United Electrical Workers are fighting to save 950 jobs as GE moves the work building locomotives to a new non-union plant in Texas. The workers rallied Tuesday to protest the plans to move the jobs to Texas. Roger Zashek is president of UE Local 506.
By GE moving to Texas, wages going to be $12 and $14 less than what their union parts are making up here. All they're doing is padding the profits. So if they're looking for any kind of concessionary from benefits that we have gathered over decades of negotiating through contracts, that's craziness because they don't lower the price to the customer.
Zashik says GE first told the union that the Fort Worth, Texas plant was an overflow plant and would only complement the work done in Lawrence Park near Erie, Pennsylvania. He says GE now must provide detailed information about the work transfer and jobs loss. He says the union will do all it can to fight for the jobs. Zashik says this is pure greed, and workers everywhere need to organize and fight back.
Everybody, join a union. Join with the cause. Be one with us instead of against us. Because divided, we can be conquered. But united, we can stand strong.
American Crystal Sugar workers will be returning to work after a long lockout. Jesse Russell reports.
After being locked out for 20 months straight, American Crystal Sugar workers have voted in favor of the company's final offer. This is the fifth time the workers have voted on the contract. The contract was accepted with only 55% of the vote. Workers in Minnesota, North Dakota, and Iowa who haven't moved on due to the lockout will be returning to work. The workers are represented by the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers and Grain Millers International Union, which worked to support the locked out workers and their families even after unemployment benefits ran out. The union's efforts made it possible for more workers to wait out the company's lockout, but an estimated 600 workers have since moved on to other jobs or have retired. Nearly 1,300 workers were locked out in August of 2011 after 96% rejected the company's contract offer. Under the new 5-year contract, workers will see wage increases of 13% over the life of the contract. American Crystal Sugar is the country's largest beet sugar producer.
The International Transport Workers Federation believes that ILWU workers locked out at Mitsui United Grain in Vancouver, Washington, are victims of an anti-union attack. The ITF is urging the public to flood the employer with messages demanding an end to the lockout. The workers have been locked out since February 27th by Mitsui United Grain. The ITF says it's an attempt to avoid negotiating with the workers in good faith over their collective bargaining agreement. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And I think it's going to be awakening to us because just like the schools, when we cut the funding for schools, now we've put it back in the budget, so they really didn't get cut. But I think now schools are starting to step up to the plate and look how they can maybe partner with private people to bring education like better into the schools.
Inequality I just ignore. Don't know what a golden rule is for, but I do know a thing or two. And if all the states were red, no blue, what a wonderful world this would be.
Yes, Representative Sue Hallam, you gotta love that. Well, we took the money out, but we put it right back. Trust us. We put it all. It's all back. It's all right there. It's in the classroom. So those 20,000 teachers and education professionals that we kicked to the curb, don't think about that. No. Bad. And for me, I look at this story, as I said in the last segment, I look at this story from USA Today, and you look at the amount of money that's being extracted from the classroom, that's being stolen from my kids' education, to put ads on billboards and blare radio ads and TV ads saying how wonderful cyber charter schools are and online learning. Since 2007, the top 10 largest for-profit operators of these cyber schools have spent almost $95 million. Now, that's $95 million that you and I think we're putting into education. That's not. The biggest one, K-12 Incorporated. And I got a lot to tell you. I love the idea that my school is now incorporated. Good American way of doing things. Anyway, K-12 spent almost $22 million in the first 8 months of 2012. Again, almost $22 million that didn't get into that classroom. Something seriously, seriously wrong. Which is why I've asked our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, to come talk to us about education and other things going on across our state. Erwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Good to be here, Rick.
So I look at this, you know, almost $95 million over the last several years spent by these 10 largest operators of these cyber, these online schools. I see it as a huge, massive waste of money.
Well, it's not just a massive waste of money. It may well be the single largest peacetime transfer of taxpayer money to private hands in the history of our country. And you mentioned this company, K-12, that was the one that spent, you know, something in the range of 25% of all of that money that USA Today and Rick Smith have described. And there's an interesting little Pennsylvania touchstone with that. The principal operating officer that was selling the K-12 poison and that established something right here in Pennsylvania, the Agora Charter Cyber Charter School, is a guy who should be familiar to you and all of our listeners. He happens to be the budget secretary of Pennsylvania now. His name is Zogby.
Yeah.
Okay, Zogby moved seamlessly from Secretary of Education in the Ridge administration to Executive Vice President or something like that of K-12 and helped establish K-12's firm footing in being financed solely by taxpayers and demanding that taxpayers not have any inside input or oversight into how their money is being spent by K-12, and then seamlessly moves right back in and is now the guy who is giving you all the slash and burn, and who's the one who cut not only $1 billion a year, that's billion with a B, not million with an M, from public education in each of the last 2 years and proposes to do it again in the current budget year, but also eliminated the state's share of this unfunded mandate to finance charter schools and took that away, so imposed that on local taxpayers as well as the billion-dollar cut. Until Zogby became budget secretary, the state reimbursed every school district in Pennsylvania at least 30% of the money that was being confiscated from them as a matter of state law by these charter and cyber charter operators, and Zogby cut that money out. And Zogby's the one who has profited and I think still has an ownership interest in K-12.
Nice. So what do you say to Sue Helms' statement that they took the money out, but we put it all back. It's all back, Erwin. The billion, it's all there, all accounted for.
You know what's really most troubling about what Sue Helms said? I think she believes it. I don't think she's lying. I think that she doesn't know what she's voted on or what she's done or what her vote has cast in that most holy of positions, that of state representative, happens to be my own personal state representative. I don't think she knows what she voted for.
And you know what's scary to me is the end of it. And listen to what she said.
I think it's going to be awakening to us because just like the schools, when we cut the funding for schools, now we put it back in the budget, so they really didn't get cut. But I think now schools are starting to step up to the plate and look how they can maybe partner with private people to bring education, like, better into the schools.
That last part, that scares me. You know, working with private people, you know, corporations. You know, I want corporations in my classroom and inundating my children with here, buy this product. And, you know, all the time we see stuff coming home with, you know, this reading test brought to you by, this reading club brought to you by. How bad is it going to get? How much more do I have to, How much more do we have to put up with?
I don't know. I mean, you know, pretty soon we're going to have the Pepsi mathematics book and the Coca-Cola English literature series.
Well, it's almost that bad in Golden, Colorado. Every report card that kids get in that school district has advertisements on their freaking report cards.
Wow. It's an outrage. And sad as it is that that happens, it's even more sad that those advertising revenues aren't going to support or sustain the school district-run schools. They're going to finance these, in part, these charter schools and cyber charter schools. You know, the schools that don't make average yearly progress based upon not my measure or your measure or the people's measure, but based upon the measure that was imposed on them by this, you know, right-wing lunatic fringe No Child Left Behind law, and based on these silly standardized tests that nobody's kids can even understand, and that teachers are being compelled to train the children for instead of teaching them how to think and have a quest for learning and intellectual curiosity. You know, we have reached a sad state. Privatization in all of its forms is being treated as if it's something new or novel or unique, and it's not. It just isn't. Whether it's the schools that we all know were private long before they were public, it's only in the last 130, 140 years that we have this notion of public schools in the United States. Until then, schools were available for the children of the wealthy, and they were private, and the rest of us and our families had to somehow muddle through. That's how they kept us down. That's how working people were kept down. But it's not just the schools. It's not even primarily the schools. These are no grand experiments. When the private schools couldn't function, they became public schools. When private transportation, urban mass transit systems were no longer profitable for the privateers, they got themselves a great big corporate welfare check, and we created public transit authorities. When the railroad and the over-the-road freight industry, over-the-rail freight industry went bankrupt, when the New York Central and the Pennsylvania Railroad first merged and then went bankrupt, we created Conrail. We created Amtrak. Those were public entities. Privatization is nothing new. They started as private. When they failed as private entities, they became public entities. Now that the public has, through our tax dollars, invested not hundreds of millions, but hundreds of billions of dollars in all of this public infrastructure for these things that really should be controlled, these public conveniences and public conveyances and public institutions that should be being operated for, by, and on behalf of the citizens, the taxpayers. We're being told that they have to be privatized, and Representative Helms somehow forgets history and forgets what the privateers did. In Harrisburg, every one of those bridges across the Susquehanna River, with the exception of the Wade Bridge on Interstate Route 81, started out as toll bridges that were run by privateers. And when they failed, when they stopped maintaining them, they became the public burden, and we taxpayers have paid for them. The Turnpike, we've paid for it. The Wine and Spirit System, we've paid for it. The Pennsylvania Lottery. You know, we used to have a private numbers business in Pennsylvania and in virtually every other state. And then we made a public one that we call the lottery. But I remember in my childhood the numbers runners.
Yep. Absolutely.
That was a private business.
Yeah, well, and then you're right. Excellent point. But the question then becomes, you know, you look at this and, you know, what's the average everyday person to do? We see this stuff happen. What's the answer to this? I mean, I look at other countries, they seem to have the right ideas as a nation, because I keep saying, look, you know, we've got a political system that really is for the 1%. We've got a political system that, as much as the right complains that Obama is anti-business, and as much as McConnell says he's the most anti-business president since Carter, business is doing wildly well and mostly off our backs.
Well, they're doing wildly well in every respect but one, and that is putting people back to work. But, you know, I think the more direct answer to your question is that we need to be honest about this, and we need to step up to the plate. After all, This is our taxpayer money, and the victims of this education one are our children.
Yep.
When a couple of years ago, Pennsylvania adopted gaming legislation that has allowed casinos to proliferate at the horse and harness racing tracks in Pennsylvania and in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh in standalone casinos, we adopted some rules with that. Okay? Not only does more than 50% of the take at those casinos come back to the taxpayers for the privilege of having the right and the license to do this in Pennsylvania, but on top of that, people who have gaming licenses are not permitted to lobby. They're not permitted to engage in political activities. They don't make political contributions. They don't influence the outcome of legislation. And if this education baloney that they call charter schools and cyber charter schools and that they refer to as competition is to in any way be deemed to be appropriate, then it has to have limitations too. And we should be demanding of people like Sue Helm, who embrace this notion so wholly and completely, to adopt legislation that prohibits our taxpayer funds that make their way into the hands of charter and cyber charter operators from being used to advertise on children's television shows, that prohibits charter operators and charter contractors from lobbying, from making political contributions, from being allowed to be involved in more than one charter operation, that prohibits politicians from being on the boards of charter and cyber charter schools, that prohibits the principals or operators, contract operators of charter and cyber charter schools from being allowed to be involved in more than one such school so that they can't pass these things back and forth and give their daughters and sons and spouses and uncles and aunts and brothers and cousins lucrative contracts all paid for with tax dollars. This can be done. This is not novel. This isn't unique. And it's not something that our General Assembly in Pennsylvania and their corollaries in other states haven't already addressed in other contexts. If it is important to do for gaming, which is a voluntary sport, why is it not appropriate to do for our children's education that is the essence of our democracy?
Yeah, I'm with you. And what I've been saying for the longest time is we need people to get out in the streets. We need people. We need to come together. And someone, Tony, sent me an email here while we were talking. He said, Rick, thought you'd be interested in this news. 1,000 Blue Mountain High School students up in Schuylkill County walked out of class today to protest the teacher layoffs and the class cuts. The school district's about $1.4 million in deficit. And they're saying, look, you know, we're taking to the streets. 1,000 kids, after the first bell, walked to the football field and left class. I mean, that's a strong statement.
It's a strong statement, and God bless them. Those are a group of heads-up kids. I wish I'd have been there. I wish I could see it. And I hope that they do more, and I hope it spreads. Because in the end, they're the people who are being denied the best possible education that we can provide to them. They're the people that are being denied even the good, if there is any good, that comes out of charter and cyber charter schools, because those schools were supposed to be the laboratory, and when we learned better practices as a result of their existence, that was supposed to be passed along to the school district run schools, because after all, we taxpayers paid for it.
Now it's proprietary. Now it belongs to somebody, and it's profitable.
Well, K-12, for example, sells the curriculum that we taxpayers paid for, and they keep on selling it every year to every school that they operate. And they don't have any charters. What they have is management contracts for somebody else's charters. And then we have these unholy and incestuous relationships where the charter operators own buildings that they lease back to the charter schools. In Philadelphia, we even had a case of one operator that charged the charter school 2 years advance rent to pay for the renovations to the building that they did non-union, of course, that they underpaid the wages on the people who did the work, and then they charged the current year's rent as well, all with tax dollars.
That's just amazing. I wanted to get your thought on this. Daryl Metcalf yesterday had a statement I found quite interesting. He was talking about the governor wants to privatize the wine and spirit shops and use that money that he thinks is going to come in to fund education. Well, Daryl didn't want to use it for education. because he had a different thought. I just want to get your thoughts on Darrell's.
But when you give money to the education establishment like this, it's like throwing it into a black hole.
It's just like throwing money into a black hole, Erwin.
Well, you know, I've never seen a bigger black hole than the money we throw into Darrell Metcalf's checkbook every week and every month of every year, and for the health care benefits that we taxpayers pay for him and the pension that he is accruing at our expense when he produces absolutely nothing. But the real intrigue here is I think Metcalf is, you know, going right down the road. He believes that education is another entitlement program that needs to be reined in. You know, and I think he's right. I think all those charter operators that are being financed by Metcalf's votes to expand and embolden the charter operators without any regulation, without any oversight, without any transparency, without any accountability, without any ethical practices, I think he's quite right. That's an entitlement program, and that we need to cut it off.
I'm with you. Cut off all the money should be one pot right into the public schools. If we got problems with it, you fix that school. You get in there and you do the hard work. There are no silver bullets here. Last line of questioning for you. You brought up the schools that was, you know, built non-union. And, you know, I saw yesterday, in fact, we talked to Abe Amoros, the legislative director over at LIUNA, about the prevailing wage bill that worked its way out of the House Labor and Industry Committee. Actually, two pieces of anti-prevailing wage legislation, changing definitions and changing the threshold.
Yeah, for road milling and so on, yeah.
You know, I'm looking at this and I'm going, you know, wouldn't it be better to put people back to work than to go after the wages at which people earn while doing that work? I mean, it seems kind of backwards to me.
Well, it seems backwards because it's backwards. Imagine, they voted yesterday to increase the threshold that before prevailing wage requirements would apply, that the community standards in our communities would apply to the wages paid with taxpayer money. They voted to increase it by 400%. Now, approach those same people and ask them if they're prepared to raise the minimum wage by 400%.
Oh, they won't raise it a dime. In fact, most of them will tell you there shouldn't be a minimum wage. People are desperate enough to work for a buck an hour, then so be it. That's the free market.
You know, we have spent generations chasing work around the world. We have ample evidence. China's not a new country. China's a very old country in comparison to the United States. China had a textile industry thousands of years ago, literally. And it ran away from China to go to Western Europe and then Eastern Europe, and then ultimately made its way across the pond to the New World. And it made it to New England, and it ran away from New England and went to New York, and it ran away from New York and came to Pennsylvania. Then it left Pennsylvania, and it went to the South, the Upper South, and ultimately the Lower South. And then it went to Central America, and then it went to Asia, and now it's back in China again. Okay, and in every instance, every time we did this, it was based upon lowering wages. So now we're going to lower the wages of the skilled construction workers. What we really want to have happen here is when we build the next stadium with taxpayer money, or the next railroad station or bus station with taxpayer money, or the next school building where our children go with taxpayer money, or the next publicly funded hospital, we want to make sure that we pay the people who did that work the least amount of money so that we can assure that we have the people with the least amount of training, so that we can assure that when our loved ones are sick and going into that county home, that they not only have to worry about their maladies and the normal aging process, but they also have to worry about whether the building's going to fall down on them or the gas lines are going to explode. Give me a break.
Yeah, I mean, I wish they would spend as much time as they have spent on going after workers' rights and attacking people. I wish they would spend that much time on, I don't know, fixing our infrastructure, fixing our whatever, maybe investing in the future, high-speed rail, broadband internet across the country, maybe, you know, helping cell phone companies a little bit so that I don't drop my call every time I go across the street. You know, just some things.
Maybe we fix one of the several thousand bridges in Pennsylvania that are at such deep risk that people cannot safely cross them.
I'm with you. I am absolutely with you.
But more sad than that, however, is that we have people like Representative Scavello, who is the chair of the House Labor Committee that pushed these bills out, or people like Representative Metcalf or Representative Helm, both of whom have you have played quotes for, audio tapes for on this segment, who continuously do such extraordinarily inconsistent things. They're taking tens of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money and putting it in their own pockets, while they vote to cut the paychecks of the people who work to pay those very taxes. And the suggestion, of course, on prevailing wage is that people in Harrisburg shouldn't get paid the same as they do in Philadelphia. And the reality of the law is that construction workers don't get paid the same in Harrisburg as they do in Philadelphia. But you know who does get paid the same, whether they're from Philadelphia or Harrisburg or Elk County or Erie or Butler or Fulton County?
Daryl Metcalf, Stephen Bloom, all
those are the ones. That's the ones. Every member of the State House of Representatives, every rank and file member gets exactly the same pay no matter where they're from.
So maybe we should look at a prevailing wage for legislators.
Yeah, and it should be based on the local community wages and from which they come.
There you go. Is there a piece of legislation on that?
No, but maybe I ought to write one.
There you go. They'll give you something to give us something to work on for next time.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. Keep me occupied in my free time.
I appreciate the time, Erwin. It's always great talking with you.
My pleasure. Thanks. Talk to you next week, I hope.
All righty, our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Beat up cars with the tires and drummers go.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
There's a secret cosmic door that connects the parallel universes of Washington and Wall Street. It's not the proverbial revolving door, but a wide open passageway reserved for those in the know. Lanny Brewer is definitely in the know. He passed effortlessly from the job of defending Wall Street wrongdoers in cases before the Justice Department to then being the department's chief prosecutor of Wall Street wrongdoing. 4 years ago, he left Covington & Burling, the prestigious Washington law firm, where he represented Wall Street clients, to head the criminal division of justice. Dismissing criticism that his long service to Wall Street banksters created an inherent conflict with his new duty to the public, Brewer insisted that he'd be a better prosecutor, quote, because of my deep experience in the private sector. Yet, he did not bring even a single case against the Wall Street executives who've been publicly exposed as perpetrators of destructive financial crimes. Not one. Why? Call me cynical, but perhaps because he was using his 4 years at Justice to pad his resume and further enhance his value to Wall Street. No surprise, then, that Brewer has now passed back through that cosmic door, rejoining Covington in a specially created position to expand its role in defending corporate clients charged with foreign bribery, money laundering, securities fraud, and such. I'm a zealous advocate, said the guy who studiously refrained from being a zealous prosecutor. I look forward to being a zealous advocate for our clients again, he added. This is Jim Hightower saying, sheesh, good at least pretend to have some ethics? Instead, Lanny was relieved to be back on Wall Street's side. "It's my professional home," he confessed. Oh, did I mention that Lanny's starting salary at Covington will be $4 million a year?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that if the full range of tax increases and spending cuts were allowed to take effect, a scenario widely referred to as the fiscal cliff, a shallow recession would occur early next year.
That's all you are to me.
Another one. You know, we set up these crises. We set up these scenarios. The end of the world's coming. The sky is falling. The end of the world. The cliff. Whatever. We have these crises. We've got to get people all lathered up. Got to get them all worried. Got to get them scared because, you know what? There's uncertainty around every corner. Be weary. There's a guy with a bag. By weary, there's a guy who looks brown. Be weary. He's acting Hispanic. You got to love that. Louis Gohmert. The headline yesterday read, GOP fast-tracks bill to fortify Obamacare's high-risk pools. And I love this because the Republicans are going to save Obamacare because that evil Obama is cutting the temporary insurance plan for folks who have these pre-existing conditions who can't get it anywhere else. So he's cutting them off till the end of the year, till the Affordable Care Act goes into effect. Think about this. They know it's only going to be a couple of months by the time it actually this piece of legislation that they've crafted goes into effect. It'll be like in effect for a month or two at most. And I love the name, Helping Sick Americans Now. It's the Helping Sick Americans Now Act. Who could be against Helping Sick Americans Now? I would say most Republicans. Because you look and you know, go back to the whole Obamacare fight, a lot of Democrats too. It's that politic. It's that push and pull, it's the messaging that comes along with it. So when I saw this story on Monday from Regal Entertainment Group, they're the people who do the Regal Cinemas in our area. They also have Edwards Theaters and United Artists Theaters. I guess 38 states they're located in. We're talking a huge, huge company. Well, they have decided all non-salaried workers will see their hours cut back to 30 hours a week so they can avoid Obamacare. Now, this is a company who in 2012 saw their stock go up by over 20%. This is a company in 2012 who every single last executive, the CEO, the CFO, the COO, they all received a six-figure pay increase. The CEO, this Amy Miles, 31% increase in her pay, $4.4 million. You know, she's got health care, right? You know that? You know, she's got a pension. You know that, right? You know who doesn't have health care and who doesn't have a pension? Well, the vast majority of the people who work at these places who make the money that can pay her salary. But that's a conversation we're not even, nobody is even considering having. It's all about Obamacare. You know, it's going to ruin full-time employment. All these big employers, all these employers are going to cut hours back to 30 hours so they don't have to pay for Obamacare because they're not going to do it. Well, you know, I have a couple of thoughts. My first one is look, I've seen a number of surveys, and the vast majority of them show that, you know, 90-95% of employers, the big ones, they're going to pay. Because, you know what, they want their people to have health insurance. They just don't want to pay for it. So if it's a little fine, they'll pay. But you're going to hear the one or two, you're going to hear a lot about the handful, because look. It's fear. Be afraid. Can I let you in on a little secret, though? And this is kind of one of those things that makes me go, is this really a story? I know a couple people who work for these theater chains. They don't work full-time hours anyway. Most of them are part-time. And I find it amazing that it's these businesses who have built their fortunes, the Papa John's of the world, the people who have built their fortunes on part-time labor, on low-wage labor, on no benefits, and, of course, no voice on the job labor, so that they're disposable. They come, you work them a little bit, there's the door. And the thing that gets me is, look at a lot of these service sector type jobs, the fast food places, the pizza delivery places, the theater places. These are places that have had a long history of shifting costs on the back of their workers, may having a business model based on low wages and high profits, a business model that cuts hours, that cuts wages, that fires workers at the drop of a hat. I mean, it's the culture of the low wage service sector. And I remember back in the 1980s, there was actually a conversation that went on for a very short period of time about what kind of an economy we want. Because Reagan came into office promising this wonderful service-based economy. Because it was his view, get rid of all that dirty industrialization, get rid of all that, let somebody else be the manufacturer. We want to do those high-skill jobs. And they sold all of us on the idea that, hey, we could all wear a shirt and tie to work, and we can all sit in a corner office, and, we can all push papers around, and we won't have to work in dirty factories, or, our backs won't ache, and all of that stuff. A lot of people bought it. Now, understand, the underpinnings of all of that was destroying worker solidarity, destroying the workplaces that were organized, which were mainly manufacturing. And when you had a manufacturing base in this country that rose wages for those folks, everybody came along. But as we see that power diminish, we're all going down. It's pretty simple stuff to me, which is why then you start going, well, back in the 80s, the majority of people had health care through their employer. Now, not so much. The numbers are falling rapidly. Think about this for a second. If every worker in this country had insurance, would we have needed Obamacare? If every job site, all these big companies gave insurance to their workers, would we need it? If McDonald's covered all their workers, would you need it? No, you wouldn't have. So there was obviously a need. And now we're seeing, okay, something got passed. I'm not thrilled with all of it. I'm of the mindset we're going to fix the things that are broken and we're going to make it better moving forward. But this is a starting point. But all I keep hearing is, it's going to be the end of the 40-hour work week. It's going to be the end of employer-based health care. And personally, I've been a fan of ending employer-based health care since I've been probably 15, the idea that I can only get health care or a pension from working for a company and being forced to work for them, so that if I get sick and let's say I'm in between jobs, whether they've stolen it from me or I've quit, explain to me how that benefits us. And I know we've had this conversation before, but at some point, you're going to have it again, because do we need the employer-based system? And it's always been amazing to me that the employers haven't said, we don't want to do it anymore. I have no idea why the auto industry didn't go, look, we're putting $2,500 in health care in every car. We don't want to do it. Why wouldn't they be the advocates of going, let the government do it. Let the people do it. We don't want to. Well, I think the answer is pretty simple. Control. They have that power to hold you within that. I can't tell you how many people I know have jobs that they just despise. But the only reason they stay is because of the health care. They know they can't get health care somewhere else. And I've said for the longest time, once we do away with that, once we make health care a right, once we say health care is something that if you need, you get, as a member of being a, as a matter of being a citizen, not if you can, if you can afford it, but as a matter of a birthright or a human right. Until then, we're going to be saddled with this system. And for me, this idea of, well, they're all going to cut hours, I'm like, good. I think we need to be cutting hours. But we need to be organizing, cutting hours, and raising wages so that a family can live on 32 hours a week or 30 hours a week. Like they do in other countries. And, you know, all of this hysteria, all of this fear-mongering, oh, you know, if the companies have to pay it, they're just going to lay people off or they're going to cut hours. There are going to be some. There are always some. There's always a handful. There's always someone who's going to try and game the system, which is why you need to have regulation and you need to have a cop on the beat. But to say that, you know, there's one, Regal Cinema is not going to pay their health insurance bill. They're going to cut hours. To say that that's the majority, I got a problem with that. Here's what we do to Regal Cinemas, though. I mean, and this is the reality. This is what the end of this means to me. Like those 1,000 kids that marched out of school after the first bell over to the football field in protest of budget cuts, in protest of teachers' layoffs. 1,000 kids came together. This should be a national story. It's what we need to be doing. So you know what? You don't go to Regal Cinemas. And you call them up and say, hey, I'm not coming today, and here's why. And make sure nobody goes. So that they go, uh-oh, our business model is failing based on our greedy decision. Maybe we should get into line with everyone else. Maybe we should respect our employees. Maybe just a thought. You know, I'm... Because I'll tell you, you know, now that I've read this, you know, I've written off Papa John's. I'll not eat another Papa John's pizza until things turn around there. And, you know, I haven't been in a Walmart, and I can't tell you how many years. Not that I'm against going to a Walmart. You treat your employees right. I'd be happy to go back. Same thing with Regal Cinemas. At this point, no more Regal Cinemas for me. There are other companies out there. There are other people out there. Personally, I don't really want to have a cinema company in 38 states. I kind of like the idea of having something local. Just a thought. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get our podcast. Also, Stitcher on the smartphone. Take the program on the go. As always, I'd like to love to hear Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Thoughts, questions, comments. Thank you, Tony, for the update. Did not see that story up in Schuylkill County. Quick break. Back with hour two. Stick around. And take your money. All they want to do is get up and take your money. All they want to do is get up and take your money. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In Erie, Pennsylvania, the United Electrical Workers are fighting to save 950 jobs as GE moves the work building locomotives to a new non-union plant in Texas. The workers rallied Tuesday to protest the plans to move the jobs to Texas. Roger Zaschek is president of UE Local 506.
By GE moving to Texas, wages are going to be $12 and $14 less than what their union parts are making up here. All they're doing is padding the profits. So if they're looking for any kind of concessionary from benefits that we have gathered over decades of negotiating through contracts, that's craziness because they don't lower the price to the customer.
Zaschek says GE first told the union that the Fort Worth, Texas plant was an overflow plant and would only complement the work done in Lawrence Park near Erie, Pennsylvania.
He says GE now must provide detailed information about the work transfer and jobs loss. He says the union will do all it can to fight for the jobs. Zashik says this is pure greed, and workers everywhere need to organize and fight back.
Everybody, join the union. Join with the cause. Be one with us instead of against us, because divided, we can be conquered, but united, we can stand strong.
American Crystal Sugar workers will be returning to work after a long lockout. Jesse Russell reports.
After being locked out for 20 months straight, American Crystal Sugar workers have voted in favor of the company's final offer. This is the fifth time the workers have voted on the contract. The contract was accepted with only 55% of the vote. Workers in Minnesota, North Dakota, and Iowa who haven't moved on due to the lockout will be returning to work. The workers are represented by the Bakery Confectionery Tobacco Workers and Grain Millers International Union, which worked to support the locked-out workers and their families even after unemployment benefits ran out. The union's efforts made it possible for more workers to wait out the company's lockout, but an estimated 600 workers have since moved on to other jobs or have retired. Nearly 1,300 workers were locked out in August of 2011, after 96% rejected the company's contract offer. Under the new five-year contract, workers will see wage increases of 13% over the life of the contract. American Crystal Sugar is the country's largest beet sugar producer.
The International Transport Workers Federation believes that ILWU workers locked out at Mitsui United Grain in Vancouver, Washington, are victims of an anti-union attack. The ITF is urging the public to flood the employer with messages demanding an end to the lockout. The workers have been locked out since February 27th by Mitsui United Grain. The ITF says it's an attempt to avoid negotiating with the workers in good faith over their collective bargaining agreement. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So, no cloture vote, no, didn't happen. 54-46, the gun amendment went down. Five Democrats voted against it, four Republicans voted for it. You had John McCain, Susan Collins, Pat Toomey, and Mark Kirk of Illinois who voted yes. But 54-46, the amendment went down. President Obama, not happy. And I look at this, and it looks dire. At this point, any gun legislation, I don't know, which is why I think we need to see more people out in the streets, more people saying, hey, you know, this is what we demand that you do. And that's why I thought it was interesting. Today, there was an action on Capitol Hill. Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America held a stroller jam on Capitol Hill this morning. They read the names of the 3,300 Americans who were killed by gun violence since Newtown. That's just since the school shooting. 3,300 people. That is just absolutely mind-blowing in my view. I've got one of the moms who was at Capitol Hill. Maureen Buckley is the co-leader of Moms Demand Action, Southeast PA and Philadelphia. We've got a link to their Facebook page at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Maureen's name. Maureen, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Rick.
So you went to Capitol Hill today.
I actually was not among the moms at Capitol Hill today. We have been organizing our own stroller jams locally along with moms across the country. But Capitol Hill today was amazing from what I hear.
So explain the whole idea in this.
The idea with a stroller jam is that moms who are busy with their regular life and have their kids with them all the time go and take the kids with them to their in-district offices or down to Capitol Hill and speak with their elected representatives and demand action on common sense gun laws.
So what got you involved in this?
Honestly, for me personally, it was what happened at Sandy Hook. I have a one-year-old, I have a four-year-old, and I think like every other American mother and every American period, it was just horrifying to see 20 innocent children and their six protectors cut down in that fashion. And it was intolerable to do nothing.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, the sad thing is sometimes it takes a tragedy like that to get action. And I got to be honest, I wish I would see more.
I am right there with you, and this is part of the reason our organization was formed. We actually formed the day of the shooting at Sandy Hook, and we went from a Facebook page to over 100,000 members in 40 states. We now have close to 100 chapters, and it's basically all moms who were never necessarily particularly engaged in the political process before. I know, speaking for myself, you know, I'm an informed voter and I vote, but this is the first time I'm doing anything like this, you know, writing letters, calling every day, saying, okay, listen, Senator Toomey, this is what we're asking you to support. We want universal background checks. We want a ban on assault weapons. We want a ban on high-capacity magazines.
And to me, you know, Maureen, it seems like common sense. And, you know, and it seems like the vast majority of people that I talk to, NRA members, non-NRA members, there seems to be consensus on common sense things that we should be doing. Nobody's talking about going and stealing, taking people's guns away from them or making them so they can't have the gun in the home and pass it down through generations. I don't think anybody's saying that. I think what I'm hearing, what I believe is, there should be some common sense stuff that we keep things out of people's hands that not necessarily in the best interest of society that they have.
I think that is exactly it, and I agree with you completely. I think there's a good deal of fear-mongering propaganda that comes from a gun lobby that is very interested in protecting itself. And, you know, unfortunately today, upwards of 40 senators chose to do the gun lobby's bidding instead of the bidding of over 90% of the American people.
Yeah, 46 of them.
That's right.
To be exact. And, you know, I look at this, and for me, that's a loud and clear message that the moneyed interests have more control over our elected leaders than the people's interest. And that, by having you go, have folks like you going out to Capitol Hill and going around to different elected officials, that's how we change it.
100% accurate. I 100% agree. And honestly, it can't just be a handful. It needs to be a significant portion of that 90% of people who say, hey, look, we are demanding common sense. It's not enough to just click like on a Facebook page. You need to make the phone calls. You need to let the folks in Washington know that we are not going to tolerate inaction like we saw today. And if they continue to not act, we will find a Congress that will act to protect our family.
From your lips, you know, but I look at this and, you know, I understand Philadelphia is a much different area than where I live in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. So I've been fortunate that I've lived I've lived in an urban area. I've lived in a rural area and the view of guns completely different in each area. Where I grew up, if someone had a gun, look out, he was hunting someone. Where I live now, I know people who have guns and they have it because, hey, they like to go target shooting. There's a free public range down the road from where I live. People go hunting and do all of those things. So there are two very different views of guns. And I think there's got to be a conversation of how you mesh those together where you could have a set of rules, say in Philadelphia or in the housing project where I grew up, and a set in a different area, in a more rural setting.
And, you know, and absolutely, you need to take context into account. One of the things we're very clear about is we don't want to ban all guns. We are not against guns. We have a lot of members who own guns. We are for responsible gun ownership, and we are for keeping guns out of the hands of people who are intent on doing harm with them. So keeping guns from the hands of criminals or those who are severely mentally ill.
Yeah, I'm with you. But the bigger the question becomes, you know, isn't our lack of funding for mental health services, isn't that part of all of this? Because, you know, a lot of this comes back to we've defunded the state hospitals here in Pennsylvania, and not just here, across the country. We've walked away from that kind of health mental health service. But isn't that part of the conversation as well?
Well, I mean, I think gun violence in general is a very complicated problem. There's no one law, there's no one set of laws that's going to fix this. It has to be multifaceted. Before I was mom, I was a behavior therapist for the chronically suicidal. And so I would 100% agree that when you're defunding mental health programs, broad-based access to effective mental health treatment is something that benefits the population in general. You know, in it's important to note that most folks who are seriously mentally ill are not violent and are not going to go on to commit violent crimes. They're actually more likely to be the victim of a violent crime.
Right, and that was what I was going to bring up. I mean, the sad reality is they're most often the victim of it. But I look at this, and I don't want to get into a situation where we're pointing fingers at this group of folks over here while ignoring the rest, where a lot of the problems could come up. And for me, just the simple background check seems rational to me. Simply knowing who it is that's buying it, you know, trying to figure out how you stop these underground sales, that seems rational to me.
It seems rational, too, and also to around, 90-92% of the population?
Yeah, see, that's evidently not enough to pass something in our Congress.
You know, and my thought here is that we need to keep being loud. We need to keep telling Congress what we want, and if they continue not to listen, then we vote them out, and we replace them with a Congress that will listen to the will of the majority of the people.
So I look at this, and one of the things I saw in your press release is that they read the 3,300 names. 3,300 people since Newtown, is that right?
That is the rough estimate, and it is horrifying.
I mean, we hear, there's a shooting here, we hear that. I can't, 3,300, it wasn't that long ago.
4 months, just over 4 months ago.
And I understand that there's a website, nomorenames.org, has all the names of the victims of gun violence. And I guess you'd have to ask the question, at what point do we say enough is enough?
I mean, I think American mothers and American fathers and just parents and people in general are at the point where we're saying this is enough.
So how do we get involved? What would parents say? There's a parent out there like you that, hey, I don't know how to get involved. You know, what's the advice?
All right. My first thing would be go to momsdemandaction.org. We have a bunch of tools that you can use. You can find a local chapter. We have chapters all across the country. You can fast email your congressional representatives. You can fast tweet them. You can call them. We have tips for, you know, how to go about making that first phone call if you've never spoken with your congressperson before. I think it's just imperative that they hear from us. They live in a bubble in D.C., and the representatives I've spoken with have said themselves they live in a bubble down there. What they know is what they hear from their constituents. So we need to let them hear from us and say, really, we've had enough.
And, you know, I encourage people to call all the time. But, you know, some people have said, you know, it's overwhelming. It's, you know, it's, you know, these are powerful people. I'm going, no, they're people just like you and just like me. They're our people.
Yeah, and they work for us.
Exactly.
You know, and honestly, when I went for my first in-district visit, I had that same feeling. I'm like, wow, okay, this is a little intimidating. They are just people, and they work for us. And they need to hear what we have to say, the people in their communities, who they represent.
So now that you guys have had this stroller jam, which I think is a great idea, where do you go from here? What's the next action? What's the hope springing out of this?
Well, I mean, at this point, we're not defeated. We have just begun to continue working for stronger common sense gun laws. And really, we start mobilizing to work on midterms. And vote in people who will support sensible gun legislation. You know, whatever may or may not happen in the House, we'll be keeping an eye on that as well. We'll have actions to keep this in the spotlight, because as much as there have been references to the Connecticut effect, we are not going away.
Yeah.
This issue is not going away, and we are in this for as long as it takes to get change.
Yeah, because what bothers me is it going to take another incident? Is it going to take another Newtown? Is it going to take another Apollo Theater? Is it going to take another one of these horrible tragedies?
And, you know, the thought has to cross your mind, if Newtown wasn't enough, if the 8 children killed every single day by gun violence is not enough, what is enough?
Yeah, I mean, as someone who has people shot, it is not a pretty sight. As someone who has seen someone laying on the ground with the life bubbling out of their chest, not a pretty sight.
It is not something anybody should have to experience, on whether as a witness or a victim or as the surviving parent. And it's in our power to try to make it more difficult for those situations to happen.
And that's why we organize, that's why we get active, and that's why we get on the phones and we write letters to the editors and do all of those things. Because look, at the end of it, even the majority of my NRA friends, they agree with common sense reality. They don't believe we should be arming teachers. They don't believe there should be a gun on every corner. They believe in common sense, rational thought.
Absolutely. And I mean, I do think there have been some quotes coming out of D.C. recently saying that the American people are ahead of Capitol Hill on wanting sensible gun laws. And I think the American people need to just keep insisting that we get sensible gun laws. And, you know, it might not be a quick process, but we really need to persist at it.
And we need to do the organizing. Go to the website, momsdemandaction.org. You can also go to the Facebook page of the group in southeastern PA. We've got a link at smithshow.com. Just click on Maureen Buckley's name. It'll take you right there. Maureen, great talking with you. Thank you for standing up. Thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much, Rick, and thank you for having me.
Anytime. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Hi, my name is Ethan. My dad is a sanitation worker at Republic Services. My dad spends a lot of time away from home doing the fourth most dangerous job in America, but he is invisible at work, and Republic Services does not treat him with the respect he deserves. Support us on Facebook at facebook.com/Republic Services Teamsters. Thank you.
There's a secret cosmic door that connects the parallel universes of Washington and Wall Street. It's not the proverbial revolving door, but a wide open passageway reserved for those in the know. Lanny Brewer is definitely in the know. He passed effortlessly from the job of defending Wall Street wrongdoers in cases before the Justice Department to then being the department's chief prosecutor of Wall Street wrongdoing. 4 years ago, he left Covington & Burling, the prestigious Washington law firm where he represented Wall Street clients, to head the criminal division of justice. Dismissing criticism that his long service to Wall Street banksters created an inherent conflict with his new duty to the public, Brewer insisted that he'd be a better prosecutor, quote, because of my deep experience in the private sector. Yet, he did not bring even a single case against the Wall Street executives who've been publicly exposed as perpetrators of destructive financial crimes. Not one. Why? Call me cynical, but perhaps because he was using his 4 years at Justice to pad his resume and further enhance his value to Wall Street. No surprise, then, that Brewer has now passed back through that cosmic door, rejoining Covington in a specially created position to expand its role in defending corporate clients charged with foreign bribery, money laundering, securities fraud, and such. I'm a zealous advocate, said the guy who studiously refrained from being a zealous prosecutor. I look forward to being a zealous advocate for our clients again, he added. This is Jim Hightower saying, sheesh, couldn't he at least pretend to have some ethics? Instead, Lanny was relieved to be back on Wall Street's side. It's my professional home, he confessed. Oh, did I mention that Lanny's starting salary at Covington will be $4 million a year?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin but the weight is. Everything's raisin but the weight is. Yes, I'm grocery and our hate is. Everything's raisin but the weight is.
1-888-520 Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there. Get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. You can also email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Look, you know, the gun thing is really a very complex issue in my view. I understand living in a rural area. I understand the culture. I got it. But, you know, the people who have grown up in the culture don't seem to get the urban culture. Where I grew up, where someone with a gun was shooting people, I've seen people shot. Not a pretty sight. And something that sticks with you. And it's not like it's on TV where it's, oh, they go down, someone gets shot, they go down, oh, and then they die. They're screaming, there's pain. Unless it's a direct shot to the heart, which I've also seen. I remember I was driving a truck for a living, and I was bobtailing to the hotel. And for some reason, and this is one of those moments where you go, you know, you can be, you know, atheist if you want, but there are moments where something kind of tells you, go over here, go do something different. Because who knows why? Who knows why I didn't park in the spot that I parked in every single time I had been to that hotel in the years that I had been going there? Who knows? Who knows why I didn't go and park in that exact same spot? I parked about 200 feet away. Yeah, I'll never know why. I never know what the reason was, never. But as I got out of the truck, I heard bang. And I looked over, saw a guy hit the ground. Saw the guy run off. Walked over, saw the guy laying on the ground. You could see the blood bubbling out of his chest. He was done. Right? And there was nothing there. And the guy who shot him, and you're going to love this story because I think it's one of those really just absolutely ridiculous, senseless, idiotic moments in history. Guy walks over to the, then he goes over, who did the shooting, walks over to the front desk where the clerk was working, points the gun at the clerk. And I couldn't see what was being, I couldn't hear what was being said, I just saw. Evidently the woman who had lived there in the hotel was ribbing him, that's not a real gun. He went outside, he threw a few shots into the air, handed the gun to the woman, and ran off into the woods. And you go, and eventually they caught him, and you know, he went to jail, and he was going to do, he plea bargained for life in prison. But here's the background to this. The guy who got shot was the foreman on a transient work crew. They were from Florida. This happened in Rhode Island. I was going to bed up near Providence, Rhode Island. They were there from Florida, building, ironically, a church. The foreman on the transient work crew from Florida was the one who got shot and killed. He sent the guy who shot him home from work that day because of an argument that he had with another worker. And you'll love this. Evidently, a co-worker of the shooter moved his flannel shirt so that he could sit down. An argument ensued, a fight broke out, and the supervisor sent both of the guys home. He said, go back to the hotel, cool off, come back tomorrow. Well, Mr. Shooter goes and gets himself some alcohol, and lots of it, because it's easily available there. Gets all liquored up, gets all whatever up. And I remember talking to a guy who was in the hotel all day and saw the guy. Just drunk out of his mind. So now I think about this. You've got this situation where if there's no gun, the state of Rhode Island isn't incarcerating someone for life at $40,000 a year. There's a guy who's a foreman of a transient work crew, whose family still sees him living and breathing, and all of this chaos that went on around it doesn't happen. But it was the gun that helped. And I know guns don't kill people. But when you look down at someone who's laying on the ground with a hole in their chest and blood is spurting out and you can see the bubbles coming out of their chest, you kind of remember that. And you have maybe a different view on guns than some. I saw people shot when I was a kid. Guy came home from work, saw his girlfriend, wife was fiddling around. Shot them both naked out in the front yard. And you go, again, this love of guns. And I get it. I've got friends who go target shooting. I've got friends who, you know, who lifelong members of the NRA, and they tell me all the wonderful things they do with guns. And look, I've shot guns before. I get it. But the conversation has to be had. You know, is this saturation a good thing for the nation? Look, we're not going to overthrow the government. And I know some of my right-wing friends will say, well, the blood of liberty, the tree of liberty has to be watered with the blood of tyrants. And I go, well, you know, that's not literal. It's not always literal. We can throw them out by unelecting them, don't you think? I mean, there's a bunch of different ways of going about this. But for me, this gun thing is, on one hand, they're playing it for all it's worth because it is the issue that people are paying attention to. And I wonder what's going on, because I look at things as political theater. And you got to wonder how much of this is the game and how much of it is truly, truly heartfelt by the Republicans. Because, look, I understand why the handful of Democrats voted against it. I get it. It wasn't going to pass with their votes. They needed that vote to go back to their district and say, hey, look, I'm a good gun toter like you. And I understand why Harry Reid, who said he was going to vote his conscience and didn't want to see another Newtown, didn't want to see another catastrophe, I understand why he voted against it, so that he could bring it back up. It was a procedural move. I get that. But I'm wondering, you know, what's coming underneath it? I'm wondering, what's the immigration bill going to have? I'm wondering, what's around the corner? Because this doesn't seem radical to me. In fact, it used to be what the NRA believed in. In fact, they testified several years back that they would be in favor of this stuff. And what blows my mind is, you know, the conservative, the right wing, the you know what, they agree to things in the past that they don't seem to agree with now, which I guess brings me back to my premise that these aren't conservatives, that these aren't Republicans. These are radicals that are running our government. These are radicals who have hijacked the House of Representatives. These are radicals who have hijacked the United States Senate. And it's going to have to take a consensus from us. The fact that 1,000 kids took to the streets and said, took to the football field and said, we're leaving school, consequences be damned, because there's power in numbers, is amazing to me. And the fact that you've got mothers who are taking their kids with strollers to Capitol Hill and to other places around the country and saying, you know what, we're taking to the street, is amazing to me. But how much media coverage do you hear of it? Not much. Not much. Let's take a quick break. Right back. When we come back, I want to talk about this most recent Supreme Court decision. Another one. I guess it was yesterday. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
If it keeps on raining, love is going to break.
Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Earth, sky.
Earth's human population has reached 7 billion and is projected to reach 9 billion by 2050. With this growing population, scientists say the depletion of groundwater is a serious issue. Most of the groundwater we use is to grow food.
Currently, about 90% of global freshwater resources is consumed by irrigated agriculture.
You're listening to Bridget Scanlon, senior research scientist at the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas. She told us that the highest area of irrigated agriculture is in India, followed by China, and then the U.S. Scanlon said water shortages are most likely to occur where irrigation is most widespread. But, she said, our human demands are putting stress on aquifers around the globe.
The health of the aquifer depends on how much water is going back into the aquifer from rainfall and recharge versus how much water you are pumping out of the aquifer for irrigation.
And we're using water from many of Earth's aquifers faster than they can fill back up, Scanlon said. We asked her what sorts of things can be done to solve the problem of accelerating depletion of groundwater.
I think an obvious thing would be to reduce irrigated agriculture. Convert irrigated agriculture to rain-fed agriculture.
Today's show was made possible in part by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
If the federal government continues to do the kinds of things that this administration is trying to do through the back door, through the National Labor Relations Board, that's killing our free market system.
We're running out of rich people in this country.
The NLRB has become a political sycophant for labor unions.
And one of the things the Congress should do immediately is defund the National Labor Relations Board.
It seems to me that what we're seeing is a ceding of power from Congress to these, to the NLRB and other agencies.
It really is a freedom versus tyranny issue.
I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world this will be.
Ah, yes, it'd be so wonderful. If we could just institutionalize wage theft, if we could just make sure that, you know, anytime we get to screw work, it's fine. And I love all the Republicans you heard saying, oh, we're going to defund the NLRB, this political sycophant. You didn't hear him saying anything during the Bush years when the Bush NLRB was destroying working conditions. In fact, I remember all the Kentucky River cases where they said, oh, you know, if you do 10 minutes of work a day as a managerial work a day, you're a supervisor. You don't have rights. No, they didn't seem to complain about that. Hey, all in favor of it. All in favor of using the NLRB against workers, yes, in favor of. But to actually stand up and say, you know what, you really can't be screwing workers out of wages. You really got to honor those contracts. That is just too far. And I look at our Supreme Court, and You go, well, I'm going to sue. I'm going to go to court. And I hear this a lot. I'll just sue if I get fired for the wrong reason or if I get cheated out of pay. Good luck on that. We learned from Lilly Ledbetter, not such a good thing. You remember, they threw out the case that she had, basically saying, and said, you know, tough luck, because she didn't file her claim in a timely manner, which is supposed to be, I guess, 180 days after it happens. Well, what if you don't know for 20 years? Well, she got screwed. And I look at this case today, or actually it came out yesterday, this decision yesterday, this Genesis Healthcare Corporation decision. It's just another one of those moments where workers lose, which is why I've asked Moshe Marvitt, fellow at the Century Foundation, tcf.org, their website, to come talk to us about this case and where we go from here. Moshe, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, hey, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
So I look at this case, and explain this to me. She was cheated out of wages, worked through her lunch, worked through her breaks. You know, she files, I guess, a lawsuit. They offer to pay her, you know, the money back. Oh, sorry, you caught us. Here, we'll pay. The Supreme Court throws it out on those grounds?
Well, what's important here is that not only was she cheated out of it, but all of her fellow nurses were. So she brought a wage and hour case and on behalf of herself and others similarly situated, her fellow nurses. And, you know, the company realizes that it could be, you know, a big case. So they turn around and they essentially try to pick off the lead plaintiff. They offer her $7,500, which is what she'd be owed. And she doesn't respond. The offer has a 10-day expiration date. And so they say, well, you didn't respond within the 10 days. That means that's all you could have recovered in court, you personally. And so there's nothing for the court to decide. There's no live controversy anymore. And so your case dies, and with it, the others as well.
So is it possible to refile it then with the other workers, the other plaintiffs then? If you make the argument, and I guess you could make an argument that, hey, she didn't respond. She didn't take what they offered. She's out of it. I guess you could make that argument. I don't agree, but I guess you could make that argument. She's out. But what about the rest?
Well, they can file on their own as well. The problem is that, you know, these cases only really work when you can build up a class and you can really get the employer to you know, pay out a large sum and change their practices. But, you know, here it was $7,500, but a lot of these, you know, wage and hour class actions, you know, aren't nurses. They're, you know, janitors, warehouse workers, people who are paid less. And, you know, the amounts are often far smaller. So if you're talking about $500-$600, you know, is a lawyer going to take it? Is someone going to really go to a lawyer? You know, the only way this really works is by building a collective action. And here the Supreme Court essentially gave the employers a formula for avoiding it. And you can see it in the National Federation of Independent Business released a statement right afterwards saying the ruling today is a victory for small businesses because it will make it easier to stop frivolous lawsuits before they become multi-million-dollar affairs.
Yeah, it'll be easier to steal wages from your workers and not be held accountable for it.
Exactly. And you know, they essentially showed how it could be done, and you know, that through this sort of technical process.
Yeah, you, when I was a kid growing up, you know, I always thought that, you know, Lady Justice was wearing the blindfold because, you know, she was not partisan. I look at this and this decision, I can't come to any other conclusion than we've got a bought and paid for Supreme Court. The corporatists have bought and paid for our Supreme Court.
Well, I mean, it's true that there's, you know, they essentially accept it as a truth, something that I think is a very controversial statement, which is, you know, in this instance, when the lead plaintiff rejected the offer, didn't respond to the offer, you know, even if that was all she could have recovered, you know, the court basically accepted the premise that she has no interest in her fellow workers' rights. And, I mean, that's just not the case. Workers have an interest in their fellow workers' rights as well.
Absolutely.
And the Supreme Court basically said that no, you know, all she could have recovered is $7,500. It doesn't matter that there's these other people's interests at stake.
Yeah, but if all of her coworkers are being cheated and the system is being torn down and conditions are made worse, won't her conditions be made worse as well? Doesn't she have that as well?
That's the argument for saying that, you know, an individual has an interest in another's rights. I mean, that's how society works. But the Supreme Court here just accepted that, you know, in making a full monetary offer, that's all she was due, rather than saying, no, this case is about more. That's why it's called a collective action under the wage and hour laws. And, you know, that she's trying to build out something for all of her workers. And, you know, based on just the way it's written, these are a little different than class actions because the workers have to opt in rather than opt out. So it takes longer, and that's why these are kind of susceptible to this sort of tampering.
You know, one of the things that just popped into my head is you go, was there any discussion about how the wage theft came about? Was this something that the company was doing deliberately? Did they make an argument that this was, well, you know, it was an accident, it was an oversight? What was the basis of the wage theft?
It was basically that the nurses had an unpaid lunch half hour, I believe. I don't think it was a full hour. I think it was a half hour. And they were just given too much work so that they worked through their lunch. And, you know, I don't know if there was, you know, really they were forced to work, or if it was just, you know, nurses care about their patients. They're not going to, you know, say they're off the clock and not do anything. So they essentially all just worked through their time, and the employer knew it. And the way the law is written is that if an employer, the language is suffers or permits the employee to work. So if they know they're doing it and they allow it, then that's all it takes. And that part of it was undisputed here.
Because, you know, I think back to the Walmart case. There was a Walmart case up in Connecticut, I believe it was, where they were sued for like $11 million, where overnight they had locked in the janitors and made them work through their lunch and actually clock, from what if I remember it right, actually clocked them in and out while they were still working and deducted the pay from, I think it was like an $11 million claim. I guess now that is probably going to be a thing of the past then, right?
It's going to be hard to get past it. Employers will read this case and realize exactly, you know, how to get around it. I was speaking with Janice Fine yesterday, who writes a lot about worker centers, and she suggested, you know, it's not worth waiting to see what happens, that, you know, this is something that Congress should just go ahead and fix, because, you know, it's a statutory issue. It's not a constitutional issue. Congress can just amend the Fair Labor Standards Act and fix this problem before it ever really takes effect.
But isn't I agree, we should be fixing the law and making sure that this doesn't happen legally. But isn't the real answer to this, the workers in those places, if they were union employees, don't they have a contract that they could have dealt with it as it was happening instead of it building up over a long period of time? And this is one of my arguments for people joining and forming associations, guilds, unions, whatever you want to call it, union democracy, worker democracies, whatever, so that those problems get dealt with the minute it happens, so you don't have all of this stuff going on?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, the truth is, you know, if there's one thing the courts respect, it's a contract. And, you know, whether they're conservative or liberal judges, they respect contracts. And that's what unions get, is they get you a contract. So you don't have to argue about what your rights are or aren't. You don't have to argue about the law. You just have to argue about what the contract says. That's the ideal. And the danger here is that, you know, the people who use wage and hour laws are often, you know, those worst off. And worker centers use them a lot. So, you know, people like janitors, warehouse workers, and people who are making the least amount often resort to the wage and hour claims. And they're usually successful, or they have been in the past, when they've been able to build collective action. But, you know, that's really in jeopardy now.
Yeah, I mean, because I look at this and I think about all of the defunding of the agencies that through government you could go through that's happened over the years. And, you know, I look at what's going on with the NLRB. All of this stuff seems to be by design, where they've created this environment where, you know, the average everyday worker, you don't have a shot. You're at the mercy of these big employers, and you know, hell be damned if you have anything negative happen to you.
Yeah, and you know, it's amazing how quickly it moved on from, you know, attacking, you know, at the same time that they're attacking the board and attacking the NLRA, you know, they're attacking these wage and hour laws. I mean, it really shows that it's not just going to happen to unions and to labor. You know, these attacks are going to happen to all workers.
Yeah, I mean, I keep. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, they're not going to be satisfied by just killing the board. That's not the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about control. I mean, for the Bush years, they had their hands firmly planted on the wheel of the NLRB, and they were using it to roll over every worker in this country. As soon as someone started saying, hey, wait a second, this is supposed to help workers. I mean, the National Labor Relations Act is about working people. It's about workers. It's about their ability to join and form unions. In the original act, not a single right given to employers.
Right. And then it wasn't supposed to. The idea was employers had enough rights as it was, and that the NLRA was supposed to balance the scales and give rights to the workers and protect the workers, because, you know, it recognized that employers in our capitalist system already have the upper hand, and so they don't need extra legal rights there. They have them. So that was the whole purpose there. And, you know, in a case like, you know, like this, with this Genesis Healthcare decision, you know, we're not even talking about protecting, you know, workers' rights to organize and get higher wages, get benefits, anything like that. We're just talking about getting the minimum wage, getting, you know, overtime that they're due. I mean, getting the stuff that's just that we take for granted.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff that of yesteryear was, well, without question.
Right, right. Now, I mean, it's you know, you may have the right to overtime or to minimum wage, but, you know, good luck if you're owed $700 by your employer, you know, good luck finding an attorney and bringing that case forward and really litigating it against the corporation unless you can build a collective action. And, you know, I don't know how workers can be able to do that anymore.
Especially if you're misclassified as an independent contractor as well. You know, we had a guy call here several months back who had been cheated out of several weeks' wages and, you know, had no recourse. The state would do nothing. He could find nothing. He was just out a couple of weeks labor.
Yeah. I mean, that's often the people who suffer the most, and that's a huge growing class. And that they're often just totally misclassified. I mean, people they just assume, well, if I call you an independent contractor and issue you I don't issue you a W-2, then you're automatically an independent contractor. And it's much more complicated than that. And I mean, I've seen numbers where it's, you know, as high as 20-25% of independent contractors should be employees.
Yeah, I mean, I look at the entire business model of Federal Express.
I mean, that's,
in my view, an entire company misclassified. So let me ask you a last line of questioning. How do we fix it? Is there any political will, to fix this, like we saw with Lilly Ledbetter, and how do we do that?
You know, I don't see it yet because, unfortunately, this case didn't even get a lot of attention. I don't know if it's because the Supreme Court's docket has been so packed with controversial cases from, you know, affirmative action and DOMA and Voting Rights Act, and there's just too many things for people to fight back against. But this case sort of went under the radar. And, you know, if it wasn't for Justice Kagan and the other three liberals on the court sort of outlandish dissent, no one would have even probably noticed because Justice Thomas's decision was just so boring. So it just sounded like a very technical, run-of-the-mill decision. But unfortunately, I don't think there's any movement building yet to push back against what this case has done. And my guess is people are just going to, you know, wake up in a year or two or, you know, maybe a couple of years and realize the damage that it did. It might be a little too late.
Yeah, I mean, I look at a lot of these really business-friendly decisions, especially the ones against class action lawsuits. I think of the Concepcion one with AT&T that said, hey, if you're going to cheat people, cheat them in small amounts over a large number so they can't come together.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to sue you for $20. If you can cheat a couple million out of $20, so much good for you.
And that's the direction, you know, the court is heading where they are trying to minimize class actions, collective actions. I mean, and, you know, if people think it's just unions, they're wrong. If people think it's just workers, they're wrong. I mean, as you mentioned with Concepcion, it's consumers as well. It's in any instance where, you know, you try to have some sort of a collective action, those rights are being diminished.
Yeah, but Moshe, we're individuals in this country, Moshe. Keep that socialist stuff somewhere else.
Well, that's essentially what the Supreme Court said yesterday.
Yeah. Sad, sad stuff. Moshe Marvin, I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you.
You too. Thanks so much.
Fellow at the Century Foundation, he's written a piece, The Most Important Case You Haven't Heard Of, maybe. We've got a link at therickssmithshow.com. Just click on Moshe's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pscu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
And so tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Yeah, I look at that, and man, you know, that is just frustrating on so many levels. You look at the decisions that have come out of this court, and I remember back when 2004 came around, and you're going, well, you know, we're going to reelect Bush, and I'm going, well, we're going to elect Bush, because I honestly don't believe he was elected the first time. That's just rehashing the old days. But I said, you know, the important thing is that Supreme Court. And a lot of people said, well, you know, I'm thinking about voting against Obama because, you know, I don't care who it is. I'm just voting. It's a protest vote against Obama. And look, there's a bunch of things that Obama's done that I'm not thrilled with. A bunch of pro-corporate policies that I'm not thrilled with. And as much as the right keeps going, oh, socialist, anti-business. Come on. You cannot make a cogent argument that this guy is anti-business or even anything remotely close to a socialist. You can't. It's just not feasible. I'm sorry. And I wish he was. But it's not. It's not happening. So I look at this and I go, okay, well, you know, back before the 2012 election, you know, people were saying, well, you know, why are you going to vote for him? Give me a reason to vote for Obama. Other than voting against the Republican or voting against Romney. And I said, you know, for me, the most simple point is the Supreme Court. if we see another extreme Supreme Court justice like Alito, like Scalia, like Roberts, we see another one of those like Thomas, we see another one of those, we're in trouble for another generation. And this court, this Roberts court, remember, this is the court that told you, he said, my court's going to call balls and strikes. We're not making new law, not doing that, except for, you know, Citizens United, and a bunch of other stuff. You know, I brought up the Concepcion case, which is huge. It basically says you as consumers, you and me, if, you know, we sign a contract and we don't realize we're getting screwed and it's only a couple of bucks, we've got no recourse. We're going to sue. And this was all over AT&T saying, okay, you have a free phone. We're giving you a free phone. We're giving you something for free. And then they charge you for it. And then they charge you tax on that. And it was them saying, well, you know, it was only a couple of bucks. But they did it to millions of people. So there was this class action suit to say, hey, you know, this is wrong. Well, they ruled you can't do it. Can't have that kind of a suit. You have to bring it individually. And you go back and you look at all of the business-friendly, and it's really, to me, it's business-friendly policy. It's not even socially conservative. This is not conservative. This is corporatist. This is radical. This is wealth based. You know, I have respect for honest, decent, understanding conservatives who truly believe in the tenets of conservatism. We can disagree and we can fundamentally argue over individual points, but I respect their point of view. These radicals, I don't understand and I don't respect. Because you look at the Supreme Court, and the last time I saw a calculation, it was like 71% of the decisions where the Chamber of Commerce had put a brief in went in their favor. That's not balls and strikes, man. That's clearly decided. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the first 2 hours of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com is where you get the podcast. You can also get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Like I said, if you missed any part of it, that's where you go. Email me, rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Looking forward to emails, especially on our bus trip. Really looking forward to the June 8th kickoff of our bus tour as we head out to San Jose, California for Netroots Nation. And then back along the way, we're going to be doing events at different locations talking about what it is that made this country great. And I'd really love to hear your thoughts, your ideas. What is it that made this country great? What is it that made us the most powerful country in the world? Is it the handful of billionaires and robber barons who brought capital together? Or was it every working stiff who did the day's work, and the next day? I'm of the mindset. It's the working people. It's you. It's me. It's our community. Quick break, back with hour three. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In Erie, Pennsylvania, the United Electrical Workers are fighting to save 950 jobs as GE moves the work building locomotives to a new non-union plant in Texas. The workers rallied Tuesday to protest the plans to move the jobs to Texas. Roger Zaschek is president of UE Local 506.
By GE moving to Texas,
wages going to be $12 and $14 less than what their union partners are making up here. All they're doing is padding the profits. So if they're looking for any kind of concessionary from benefits that we have gathered over decades of negotiating through contracts, that's craziness because they don't lower the price to the customer.
Zajic says GE first told the union that the Fort Worth, Texas plant was an overflow plant and would only complement the work done in Lawrence Park near Erie, Pennsylvania. He says GE now must provide detailed information about the work transfer and jobs lost. He says the union will do all it can to fight for the jobs. Zajic says this is pure greed, and workers everywhere need to organize and fight back.
Everybody, join a union. Join with the cause. Be one with us instead of against us, because divided, we can be conquered, but united, we can stand strong.
American Crystal Sugar workers will be returning to work after a long lockout. Jesse Russell reports.
After being locked out for 20 months straight, American Crystal Sugar workers have voted in favor of the company's final offer. This is the fifth time the workers have voted on the contract. The contract was accepted with only 55% of the vote. Workers in Minnesota, North Dakota, and Iowa who haven't moved on due to the lockout will be returning to work. The workers are represented by the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers International Union, which worked to support the locked-out workers and their families even after unemployment benefits ran out. The union's efforts made it possible for more workers to wait out the company's lockout, but an estimated 600 workers have since moved on to other jobs or have retired. Nearly 1,300 workers were locked out in August of 2011 after 96% rejected the company's contract offer. Under the new five-year contract, workers will see wage increases of 13% over the life of the contract. American Crystal Sugar is the country's largest beet sugar producer.
The International Transport Workers Federation believes that ILWU workers locked out at Mitsui United Grain in Vancouver, Washington, are victims of an anti-union attack. The ITF is urging the public to flood the employer with messages demanding an end to the lockout. The workers have been locked out since February 27th by Mitsui United Grain. The ITF says it's an attempt to avoid negotiating with the workers in good faith over their collective bargaining agreement. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Last year, 120,000 people over the age of 60 in the United States of America had their Social Security payments garnished because of student loan debt. It is a multi-generational crisis. And anybody who has, you know, sweated over their sons and daughters' student loan payments knows that it's not just about students. It's about all of us.
$120,000 seniors get Social Security garnished because of student loan debt. I mean, this has really gotten out of hand. And you look at the number. I saw it was $1.1 billion, is it? $1.1 billion in student loan debt being held by this generation going forward. And you wonder, you know, are they going to be able to participate in the economy the next 20 years? Is this good public policy? You know, we've talked to people from all around the world where they look at us and they go, what is wrong with your country? You're saddling the next generation with massive debt. Something wrong. I talked to a kid from Argentina here. He was one of the workers at the McDonald's with the J-1 visa situation. And he said, you know, it's mind-blowing. In Argentina, they pay for education. We don't have to take out loans. I guess it maybe is only in America. It's something that we have to be looking at going forward. How do we fund higher education? How are we going to get my kids to get into college? That's why I've asked Sarah Goldrick-Robb, an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin, to come talk to us about her testimony to the Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions in the Senate. Sarah, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, no problem.
So I look at this massive debt that we've saddled this generation going forward with this $1.1 billion, it's amazing to me that this is where we've ended up.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty incredible. It is. It's a growing problem, and it's a problem that has resulted from a number of policy choices that we've made over the last 30 to 40 years.
And, you know, I asked the question, you know, at what point do we start talking about, because we keep hearing that in order to move our economy forward, in order to grow the economy, we need to have education, you need to be part of the middle class, you need to get a college degree. Yet we're making it completely unaffordable.
That's right. And I think that the question is, when are we going to have the serious policy discussion about who's supposed to pay for the education? The way that we have framed this over the last, like I said, 30 to 40 years, is that a college education primarily benefits the person who goes to college. They get a higher wage. But the fact of the matter is, as you just said, the future of this country, the economic competitiveness of this country, but also the democracy that we're founded on, depends on an educated citizenry. And that means that the benefits of going to college accrue to all of us, which means we all need to make the investment.
Absolutely.
If we make the investment collectively, in other words, frankly, if we make the investment through our taxes, then we can provide an inexpensive system of higher education, and we do not need student loans.
Is there a point in our history where we actually did that?
Yes, there is, and this is very important. I'm very concerned that more and more people who are out there talking and voting don't remember the time in which we were not doing it this way. So we did it this way in the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s. We said we need more people to be going to college, and we need more colleges. So we invested, for example, as a country, in creating the nation's community colleges to open the doors all over the nation to create more seats for students. We invested in the GI Bill. We wanted to not just send our guys back into a labor force that couldn't sustain them. So we sent them to college on the public dime. Then what we did was we said we're concerned that the poorest people in the nation, the people who are the most vulnerable, who need college to get out of poverty, they won't be able to afford to go to college and not be working. Right, because they need work in order to pay their rent.
Right.
So we'll give them a Pell Grant. So we created the Pell Grant. Now, that was 1972. 6 years later, under the pressure of a number of lobbyists, which included the private colleges and universities and the growing body of for-profit institutions, they said, wait a minute, what about these middle-income students, these middle-class students who are really actually wealthier students? They want to be able to go to private colleges, too, not just public. So why don't we finance student loans? Why don't we create the possibility you could borrow, and then you could choose to go to Harvard or one of these other schools? We created the loan industry,
Yep. And
everything took off. And Harvard started jacking up its prices and saying, look what we can offer. So Princeton did it, and Yale did it. The next thing you know, the public colleges and universities are saying, we want to look like them, and you should borrow money to come to a school like ours. It's fast forward, and now we have prices, even at public institutions, that price out 90% of the nation and force everyone into borrowing, and we're told it's good for us. In fact, we're told that $26,000 a year in loans, $26,000 total in loans, is a good deal because that's what you would pay for a new sedan. But the fact of the matter is, poor people don't buy new sedans.
Nope. They buy old jalopies.
Yes, they do. That's right.
And, you know, the thing is you brought up the GI Bill, and I look at the modern-day GI Bill where the guy's coming back for more. They've given them a bunch of money, and the reality is that they're using it at these for-profit online
colleges.
That's where
they are. Yep.
And it's really, it's really sucking investment out of the rest of higher education. And it's, to me, it's this model of profitizing education, not even about education, because it doesn't even matter if people are critical thinkers or get a job skill. It's about the profit.
That's absolutely right. Look, we've attached dollars to students, and they've been turned into
a commodity.
You know, what business wants. Yeah, they're commodities, what business wants to attract. And so, you know, essentially, and I'm amazed that people don't say this more often. Look, when we talk about vouchers in K-12, we all know what that means. The Pell Grant today, and the loans in particular, are vouchers. And so the schools spring up to absorb these vouchers. And, you know, we have given them no reason not to. All they have to do is get these folks in the door. They don't even have to graduate them to get the money.
Yeah, and there's something seriously. I mean, you know, I look at this, and Jim sent me an email during the break, during this conversation. I said $1 billion. It's actually
$1 trillion.
Yes. Dollars.
Yes, I didn't want to correct you.
No, I didn't realize it's what I said. $1 trillion, because it's a huge number that could be spent. Oh, I don't know. In the economy, getting these people's lives moving forward so that they're buying houses and then they're buying all the other things that go into the houses. To me, yeah, by draining their ability to participate, and just from an economic standpoint, by taking this and saddling them with this debt, you're really draining the next generation of an economy that can grow.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that, you know, okay, so here's what the economists would say, and I'm not an economist, I'm a sociologist, and we do look at the world a little differently. But I think what an economist would say is, okay, if you're going to borrow money to buy something, education's a good thing to buy, right? That's why they say it's a good debt. The thing is, education is such a good thing. We shouldn't have to borrow
Yep.
to buy it. We should be providing it. Right? I mean, food is a good thing to have as well, but we don't want our food to be so expensive that we can't eat, right? Because then we will eat less than we need to be healthy.
Well, this
is the case where only one out of every 10 people from families earning less than $20,000 a year is getting a college education. That is not good for the health of our nation. What we're doing is driving up further income inequality, which is precisely what has created the havoc that we're in right now.
And I've been making the argument for the last couple of years that exactly what you're talking about in the higher end spectrum, they want to do K-12, and that be the
yeah.
dividing ground between the very wealthy and, well, everybody else.
Right. No, I mean, what a public system ought to be doing is ensuring that there's enough money to provide a high-quality public option. You do that through progressive taxation. Then, if the wealthy would still like to send their children to a private institution, then they essentially pay twice. They pay once through their taxes and twice when they send that kid to school, to the private school. Now, here's the beauty of all this. The private schools know that high-quality classrooms are diverse. And that is why private institutions take their endowments and invest in using scholarship money to bring people who represent diversity to them into the schools. So the thing is, we could end the public subsidy to the private schools.
And they will still
recruit poor kids.
And we absolutely should. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, and it's, as I've been arguing on the K through 12 level, we're propping up the privateers, we're propping up the propping up the profiteers, and it's not benefiting us. I mean, to me, education is about more than just getting a piece of paper to hang on the wall. It's about mm-hmm. critical thinking. It's about problem solving. It's about being a decent citizen. And I think, and I wish we would go back to looking at education in that vein. My problem is we keep seeing politicians and we keep seeing people saying, well, you need to get an education, get a job.
Right.
And that, to me, is the absolute wrong focus.
Yeah, well, at the very least, we could probably all agree that it isn't actually about getting a job. It's about getting a life where you can hold down, you know, jobs for longer periods of time. You can have some stability in your life. And that comes from not only getting a small set of very technical short-term skills, but learning to think. Those of us that have obtained those critical thinking skills that are transferable across jobs are going to enjoy relatively stable lives in which we'll have, you know, maybe two or three jobs across our lifetime. This is moving towards an age in which people are going to have 7 and 10 and 15 jobs. And that is, frankly, that's exhausting. And it's not good for family life. And it's not good for, you know, the fabric of society where people want to stay together and be around each other.
Right.
So, you know, I think we're really headed in precisely the wrong direction. And what I tried to tell the senators yesterday was all you have to do is take a page out of history and look and actually study the situation to know that you can unravel this and we can actually move forward by undoing the mistakes of the past.
And what kind of reaction did you get from them?
Well, I'll tell you what, I thought I was going to be thrown out of the place, but I wasn't. You know, Senator Harkin, in particular, the chair of the committee, the sense I got from him, and I've watched the hearing, you know, to see if I was just delusional, but the sense I got from him was that this is refreshing. because so many people, I think, have just bought into this is the new normal, get with the program, be pragmatic, there's no new money, you know, this is the austerity talk. And they don't recognize that it's powerful people who want us to think that way and to give up.
Yep. I'm right there with you. And, you know, and I look at this, and but some would say, Sarah, that you're talking about socialism, and it's the creeping socialism that'll take over, and then there'll be nothing for the free market.
You know what? I think we actually screwed up, because the free market is not what we have right now. We have an incredible government intrusion into the free market. These student loans, that's not the free market. The free market says that when private institutions open up, it should be because there's consumer demand for them with their own money.
Yeah, good point.
And they should be closed when we're not subsidizing them with government. I mean, these places are open because people can borrow government money to pay for them. That's not a free market. That's a government intrusion. So, you know, they keep saying get your hands out of the public colleges or get out of the business of the colleges and universities. No problem. We will love to take our money back. And we don't have to be in your face. We don't have to have your regulations. You don't have to have any of it. But don't take taxpayer money.
Yeah, I'm with you. Last line of questioning then. You know, how do we get to that point to where education is more affordable? Because I got to be honest, I've got three kids. I'm worried like hell that I'm not going to be able to afford to help them go through school. And they're going to be saddled with massive amounts of debt, or they're not going to be able to go.
Yeah. The only way I see it happening, frankly, is through a set of things that have to occur. Now, the problem is the first step. Okay, so the first step is the Higher Education Act is going to come up for reauthorization next year. This is the act in which we could end guaranteed federal student loans. We created them with this act in 1978. We could undo it and end them. If we end them, you can't borrow to go to college. So the next step is that taxpayers have to lean on their legislators to say, okay, well, we cannot afford to go anymore. That means you have to put in appropriations to fund these schools to drive down their tuition. That is what Minnesota just did. The people in Minnesota, the legislators in Minnesota, are trying very hard to increase appropriations to higher education to lower the tuition. It's a one-to-one relationship. You can make your state college and university a heck of a lot more affordable by just making those legislators put money into it.
Absolutely. I mean,
so you do that, now your public colleges and universities get more affordable. Okay? Now, the private ones are still really expensive, so they have a choice. They can either lower their prices so that people will go to them, you know, or they can close. And so, you know, I mean, those are basically their options, or they can start using their endowment to drive down their prices. But it sounds ludicrous, mainly because we haven't had real public action. We haven't had a large number of people say this is enough. What we've had are the bottom 40% saying this is enough, and they're disempowered. We need 90% of the country saying with one voice, this is too much. The loans are driving it. We don't accept the condition of having to take student loans to get a college education. We're willing to pay for it, put the money into providing it.
And to highlight what you've said, you know, I talked to one of the a professor here locally who said, you know, back in 1982, the cost of higher ed at the state system of higher ed, the Pennsylvania higher ed schools, the state and federal government, the taxpayers picked up 2/3 of the cost of higher ed. The student picked up 1/3. Today, the students are picking up 3/4 of the cost of higher ed.
That's
exactly what you're talking about. I hear my Tea Party friends saying redistribution of wealth. Here it is right in front of us, a massive redistribution of wealth onto the backs of students today. And it's flat wrong. And I agree, something needs to be done. And this is a good idea. I'm going to look more into it.
Thank you. I'm thrilled.
I appreciate the time. I'd love to have you come back and tell us more in the future as this continues.
Thanks so much.
Sarah, thanks so much. Sarah Goldruck-Rabb, Associate Professor at the University of Wisconsin. Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
There's a secret cosmic door that connects the parallel universes of Washington and Wall Street. It's not the proverbial revolving door, but a wide open passageway reserved for those in the know. Lanny Brewer is definitely in the know. He passed effortlessly from the job of defending Wall Street wrongdoers in cases before the Justice Department to then being the department's chief prosecutor of Wall Street wrongdoing. 4 years ago, he left Covington & Burling, the prestigious Washington law firm where he represented Wall Street clients, to head the criminal division of justice. Dismissing criticism that his long service to Wall Street banksters created an inherent conflict with his new duty to the public, Brewer insisted that he'd be a better prosecutor, quote, because of my deep experience in the private sector. Yet, he did not bring even a single case against the Wall Street executives who've been publicly exposed as perpetrators of destructive financial crimes. Not one. Why? Call me cynical, but perhaps because he was using his 4 years at Justice to pad his resume and further enhance his value to Wall Street. No surprise, then, that Brewer has now passed back through that cosmic door, rejoining Covington in a specially created position to expand its role in defending corporate clients charged with foreign bribery, money laundering, securities fraud, and such. I'm a zealous advocate, said the guy who studiously refrained from being a zealous prosecutor. I look forward to being a zealous advocate for our clients again, he added. This is Jim Hightower saying, sheesh, couldn't he at least pretend to have some ethics? Instead, Lanny was relieved to be back on Wall Street's side. It's my professional home, he confessed. Oh, did I mention that Lanny's starting salary at Covington will be $4 million a year?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Democrats in the Senate are terrified that in 2014, the next election, 20 Democrats are up for election, 10 of whom are in very Republican states. If they try and raise taxes, if they shut the government down because they're having a hissy fit that they insist on their little tax increase and that they'd rather shut the government down than not get their tax increase, the Democrats will get wiped out in the Senate in 2014.
Don't blame it on sunshine. Don't blame it on moonlight.
I look at this gun thing, and man, you know, the five Democrats that voted against it. Look, Harry Reid voted against it purely on the procedural part, so he could bring it back up. He was going to vote for it, but the other four, it's just, you know, the Baucuses of the world, and you just gotta wonder. I don't know. Anyway, let's find out more about the gun issue. I've got our good friend Jake Long on the line. Jake, what's up, man?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. I don't know if you saw that a couple of the crazy Republicans, Rand Paul, held a press conference, and shamelessly, and there were a couple other Republicans there with him, and he shamelessly accused the president of using the Connecticut families as political props. And I saw a rebuttal by the president, and every now and then you can see him. He's pretty controlled. He hides his feelings pretty well, but he was visibly angry. And his answer was right on. He said, look, he said, do they really believe that these families, along with thousands of other families who have been impacted, who lost loved ones from gun violence, don't have a right to be involved in this issue? And of course they do. And the NRA, and he said the NRA lied, and I think he was absolutely right, Rick. The NRA is claiming that it created a Big Brother, a Big Brother system, when in fact, the bill created the opposite. They also lied and said that if you limit clips to 10 rounds, it makes no difference. Well, that just, again, flies in the face of the truth. There's a story coming out of Connecticut where, in fact, that's exactly what happened. This killer came in, and he ran out of bullets, and by the time he changed clips, several children ran out the door, and it actually saved their life. So, you know, what's disturbing is, Rick, that not only is the NRA very much a minority, and the radicals within the NRA, but it's a minority, but it seems that there's a minority within Congress that is basically dictating what comes out of Congress, and that's a real threat to our representative democracy.
Yeah.
I mean, this bill was very moderate. It kept the big loophole. In other words, yes, it closed the loophole at the gun shows, but it left the big loophole if you sold a gun to a friend or a family member. It didn't close that loophole. In other words, it was a very moderate bill, and even that couldn't pass. That is really frightening. I mean, but the president did say, and the families from Connecticut that were there said, this isn't over, we're not giving up, we're going to come back. And that's great to hear.
Yeah, well, we'll see where it goes. I'm personally not hopeful. I think this is probably going to be the death of it. This was, as you've said, very moderate, and this couldn't pass. And again, it goes back to Harry Reid making the wrong decision about all these cloture votes. Everything's got to go to a 60-vote majority. That's going to clog up our entire system, which it's supposed to. I mean, that's what the Republicans want to do. Nothing. So here we are.
Well, I know that I had heard Senator Casey was talking about that specific issue, and not only is that 60 cloture vote being used to knock over the head of the average American, I mean, the Republicans are using that at appointments to all kinds of important agencies through, and this time, as you know, Harry Reid couldn't get the 60, but Senator Casey did say, if the Republicans keep this up and it gets too bad, some of the people who are recalcitrant on the Democratic side next year, and I know beginning of each year in Congress, you can decide the rules that you want to apply to the way Congress is run. They have another opportunity, and hopefully next year some of these Democrats will see the light and eliminate that 60 cloture rule, because the minority is really trampling on the rights of the majority, and I don't think the founding fathers really envisioned that, nor do they want that.
Yeah. So on the state level, what's going on the state level?
Well, on the state level, there is some, I think there's some optimism, a huge, huge transportation funding rally. Probably the biggest turnout I've ever seen up in the Capitol, up in the DS. It was actually that full that there were some people down on the floor. You had representatives from the Senate and the House, both Republican and Democrat. You had industry people, some transportation companies like your ex-employer Roadway. You had union representatives, your international, ex-international, the Teamsters, the laborers were there. It was good to see a conglomeration of vested interests that are saying, look, we need to do something. And just to give you a backdrop, and I know you know this, but for some of our listeners, the governor has been woefully inadequate in funding transportation. I mean, he set up a commission to study the problem late last year. That commission came out with a report right prior to his budget that he came out with earlier in the year, and they recommended that the governor fund it at $2.5 billion every year for 5 years. Well, the governor then comes out and says, well, I can only give you $2.5 billion over 5 years. Woefully inadequate. These people know it. They have come up with some what I would consider I'm not going to say ingenious. I think they're kind of off the track as far as raising money. I would call some of the things they're doing maybe a little bit questionable. But I'll go through them. But they claim that they can raise about $1.9 billion a year. It will create 100,000 jobs. Now, that's the positive. Let me quick go over some of the ways they plan on raising the money.
You and I are going to pay more.
They want to lift the cap on the oil franchise tax. They claim that that will add about 23 cents a gallon. That's a conservative issue, a conservative estimate. They're saying that all the fees that they're going to enact, plus the added cost at the gas pump, will cost an average driver that drives around 12,000 miles a year $2.50. Now, are those numbers going to hold true? That does not sound like an awful lot for improved roads. As you know, Rick, Pennsylvania has more bridges that need to be repaired than any state in the country. Over more than 5,000 miles of our roads of the 12,000 are needing repair. We have a lot of things that we can spend this money on that need to be uplifted. This is not just to give the average citizen good roads. This is also an economic developer that we need for our state. They're talking about a $500 fine for those who forget to pay for their license. So if you get caught without a license, automatic $500 fine.
Well, then don't do it.
That's right. Well,
there you go.
That's a lot of money, but they're looking for ways, and that's one of them. I mean, if you're using your roads, I mean, their point is, look, you got to pay for it. If you don't, you're going to pay a stiff fine. Here's another one that may or may not be controversial.
Okay, last one.
Quickly, if you get caught speeding, right, and you go into court, and I know I've done it, and I know you've done it, and you say, hey, look, I want to plead to a lesser charge. I don't want the points. They'll say, okay, we can do that. But they can now fine you, if the cop and the judge agree to that, they can now fine you between $100 and $250, and that's going to be decided
correct.
By the judge.
Sliding scale based on what you're willing to take. No surprise there. So, hey, you know, nothing really accomplished. It'll be interesting to see where this goes, though. So, again, you know, it's at least something's being done.
Yes, and by the way, they did say that they think they can get the bill passed by June.
All right.
And if they can get it passed by June, they can actually get some of this money in this short season. You know, it's seasonal. When the bad weather comes here, it's tough.
Yep.
It's tough to do some of this work. But hopefully some of this, if it passes, and it probably will, that they can get this money out and create more jobs and do some of the repair of the roads in Pennsylvania that's sorely needed. So that's
right.
Possible.
Good. I appreciate the update, Jake. Thanks so much.
All right. See you, Rick.
Let's go to line one. I got Andy waiting on line one before the break. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Hi, Rick. How you doing?
I am good. What's going on?
Hey, I heard you talking about education.
Yeah, $1.1 trillion in student loan debt held by our college students.
You know, back in 2003, that was only $200 billion.
Yeah.
That's the increase it's been. Astronomical.
Well, you've seen the massive growth of these for-profits.
Well, they're just sticking it to kids. I mean, it is amazing. You know, in education, it's like an 8% inflation rate every year, up like 60% or so in 20 years, I think. It's just horrible to put that kind of debt on a young person.
But like, you know, Sarah said, you know, it comes down to policy. It comes down to the decisions those people in Washington and people here in Harrisburg and people in state houses across the country make.
Absolutely. Huge wealth transfer.
Absolutely.
Tremendous. And you brought this up with that APSCUF stuff, three-fourths. And I went to a state university in PA. Three-fourths of the bill was paid by the state. Now you have to pay three-fourths of the freight. It's awful.
Well, yeah.
And all because we don't tax the rich and the corporations aren't paying their fair share to this country. Pretty simple.
Which is why I say we need to be out in the streets, which is why I'm glad to see those kids up at that high school up in Schuylkill County, 1,000 of them, say, you know what, we're protesting against the cuts to education. We need to see more of that, Andy. It's just
absolutely.
What it is.
Absolutely. It's in their benefit. Hey, I sent you that stuff about H-1Bs.
Yeah, I'm
That's another thing.
Working on something on that.
Yeah, good times, bad times. It's always time to screw American workers with H-1Bs. Bring it from 65 to 110,000 right off the bat with that bill.
Nice.
That's unbelievable. And, you know, the majority of H-1Bs, it's baloney to say that they're taking a skilled, very skilled job. They go in at entry level. How can they be skilled jobs if the vast majority of H-1Bs are entry level jobs?
That's a good question. It's one we're going to have to deal with here in the coming days as this unrolls. And we will, we're going to talk about this. I'm still working on where I'm at with this.
And Nordstrom's and the Boston Red Sox are two of the employers that hire H-1Bs. Gee, there's some real high-skilled tech workers that must go into Nordstrom and work for the Boston Red Sox.
Yeah.
And, you know, every job I've applied for asks if I'm an H-1B. Everyone.
Why is that?
I mean, normal operating procedure for all employers.
Well, they might get some kind of tax break for it.
You know, it's like having a captive client that's not going to complain, or they're totally captive to you for their livelihood and existence.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing
for an employer.
Yeah, we got a lot to do, Andy. I appreciate the call, man. I got to take a break here.
All right, big time. Take care. Thanks for everything you do.
Appreciate it. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Well, one of my favorite right-wing crazy Republican Congressman, Louie Gohmert. Again, you know, you got to love where they get this stuff from, because maybe it's they think nobody's really paying attention. Maybe they think nobody watches C-SPAN's Washington Journal. But Louie was on earlier today, and I love this idea that, well, Al-Qaeda has learned. You know, these radical Islamists, they're trained to act Hispanic. I love that. I just find it rather comical. Just nuts. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world and in Washington, D.C. I've got Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Justin, so what do you think? Al-Qaeda now acting Hispanic.
Well, I have a lot of Hispanic friends, and now I'm going to be second-guessing them, obviously. I'm going to be, casually mentioning Islamic Jihad, see if they catch on, and maybe get some of that sweet FBI reward money.
And, you know, I was watching CNN yesterday, which the coverage of this has just been disgusting, in my view. But, you know, they're saying, well, you know, watch out for people carrying large, heavy bags.
No, that's certainly the feeling down here as well. You know, we have cops now at every metro who are just sort of keeping an eye on things. And as somebody who carries a backpack to work, I, feel like I'm doing something illicit. But nevertheless, that's just kind of how things are in D.C.
Well, you look like a shady guy anyway. I think
I do look like a shady guy.
Even if you weren't carrying a bag.
Well, you know, I am a shady guy. You know, I'm surprised I've gotten away with as much as I have.
But are you someone who could act Hispanic? That's the thing. Maybe that's what it is. I'm better than I can, because my wife could understand that. I obviously could not. But, you know, when I'm looking at this, you know, I look at the coverage of this, and the coverage has just been, I guess it shows just how bad our media structure is. First, it's all about the blood and the gore, and then it was, hey, let's be first to announce that they caught somebody, even though we're wrong.
Yeah, no, there was about 45 minutes today where CNN had to change their story about three times. Initially, they reported that there was a suspect. Then they announced that they had his name. Then they announced that they had apprehended him, and there was going to be a press conference detailing that at 5 o'clock. It turned out that the two aspects of that were not true. There was no name released, and there was no actual suspect apprehended. But what we do have instead was apparently some grainy security footage, or maybe not grainy, but some security footage that showed the suspect. But that's a far cry from what they were breathlessly reporting for about 45 minutes.
Yeah, my producer Brett was telling me that on the internet they were going after the guy who and you know sending ill thoughts his way on the internet. And I'm going, well, if he's on the internet, don't you think that if they had the guy in custody, don't you think that it was not the guy that they got? Just a thought.
That would make sense, I guess. But, yeah, no, nevertheless, it's been a crazy day. There's been so much weird information that sort of leaked out about this, and so many, chances to backtrack, which really isn't that odd for, disasters that we've seen in the past. But at some point, you would have kind of hoped that maybe people would have learned a lesson from 9/11 when we heard, hours and hours of false information coming out that a lot of times never really got corrected, especially not in conspiracy theory circles.
No, I love some of the conspiracy nuts coming out. The Alex Jones one is the best. You know, it's the Illuminati and it's the banking elite who have these false flags, and this is all just the bankers who are trying to keep us distracted. I'm going, wow, that's. You know, I generally have some bizarre thoughts sometimes. I'm not bankers.
Well, it's a bizarre view of the world where you do not have people who are genuinely angry or, violent. And that's just I want to say in some sense it's sort of a rosy picture of the world. It's a lot more convenient to believe that this is all part of some master plan, and I'm sure that helps a lot of people sleep at night. But we live in a chaotic world, and this is just further evidence of it.
Yeah, and my thought is, and I'm, it's just purely speculation. It's probably somebody who last year got tripped during the Boston Marathon and ticked off about it. And I'll show you.
Well, my theory was it could have been a fat guy who couldn't qualify, and I would understand that sort of, feeling of rejection.
Because he could carry the bag. And I get it. Yeah, there you go. But what's interesting to me is I look at the Texas Attorney General, this Greg Abbott, who said that, and again, it's more of this divisiveness. And for me, when the president came out and said, well, today it's not about Democrats and Republicans. And I'm going, well, why'd you bring that up? Because nobody else did. On the day, why bring politics into it at all? Yet here I see the attorney general down there in Texas saying, the worst, the biggest threat to this country is not North Korea. It's the Democrats. And I'm going, really? After this, you're really going to go there? And the sad reality is, yeah.
I mean, that's just how we go. We live a world in a weird kind of prism like that. And, at some point, people are going to take it a little bit too far. And in situations like these, that's, evidence enough for that phenomenon. And so, it's tragic, but that's how we go.
Yeah, so yesterday, Mitch McConnell said that we've become too complacent about terrorism. And I'm not quite sure. Maybe I didn't understand what he was saying. Do you think it was his view that our agencies have become too complacent, or we, the people, have become too complacent? Because I got to be honest, I don't know how you can live in constant fear every minute of every day. I think at some point you have to go, okay, these horrible things happen, but you got to live your life.
No, it's very true. And, he may have said that with, the goal of having a beefed up, secure border or whatnot or something along those lines. But nevertheless, it is sort of an odd thing to say. This is something that nobody really could have predicted. I believe at a certain point in time, unless you have around-the-clock security at every event or every major gathering of people, which is certainly not a realistic view of American society, you're going to have situations like these probably come up every dozen years or so.
Yeah.
And, frankly, it's more shocking that we haven't seen more small random acts of violence like this carried out in the name of terror or whatnot.
And just so I get this right, nobody's taking responsibility. Because if I'm Al-Qaeda, what the hell? Yeah, we did it. What the hell?
Yeah, that's actually what's so interesting about this. Usually when we see an attack like this there or in Afghanistan or other foreign agencies or other foreign areas, we see a rush to take responsibility from a whole number of terror groups. But in this situation, we know that at least the Pakistani Taliban, the Pakistani branch of Al-Qaeda, has come out and said specifically that they did not do it, which seems a little strange since this seems like something that they would want to get their fingerprints on.
Yeah, you think somebody want to take credit for it before they get caught. Much like the letters, I guess. A couple of letters are yesterday one sent to the this Republican senator from Mississippi, Wicker, and I guess another Rison letter sent to President Obama.
Yes, and it looks like there was a man who was arrested for it in Corning, Massachusetts, I believe. That is moving forward. But nevertheless, that really sparked a lot of, interest in D.C. today. And we saw situations where some of the Senate office buildings were locked down for considerable periods of time. I was actually down there this afternoon watching hazmat teams move in and around the building and watching Capitol Hill police looking underneath, bushes and whatnot. It really highlighted sort of the tension that's going on right now. And it's really hard to tell whether or not this was a copycat move or if this is just craziness that happens that we usually don't pay attention to as frequently as we should. Nevertheless, it is sort of evident of the, heightened security that we have going on right now on the Hill.
No, I mean, I don't even know where you would get a hold of ricin, to be honest with you.
I've seen Breaking Bad, and it doesn't look that hard, but then again, I guess it's just a TV show.
Yeah, well, I've never seen that either, so I guess maybe,
oh, you're missing
maybe
out.
I need
you're
to watch
out.
It.
If you ever have 13 hours to kill.
To kill, right?
Yeah.
I wasted time on that, The House of Cards, which, did you see that one?
I've seen about 5 episodes of it, and it is pretty good, but it is not an accurate depiction of DC by any stretch of the imagination.
The head guy in the house isn't going to kill somebody in a parking garage? Come on.
I guess not, you know, unless if we are drastically, underestimating Kevin McCarthy. But he seems like a pretty nice guy, despite his politics.
Yeah, good point. So I guess the Toomey Mansion thing not such a hot idea after all.
No, that failed in the Senate today by a 54-46 vote. This was not a far-reaching bill. This was something that was essentially just closing the gun show loophole and making it so people cannot purchase firearms online without submitting to a background check. Not necessarily ground-shaking stuff. This did not include an assault weapons ban. This is not an attempt to remove weapons from anybody. But nevertheless, it was cast as too extreme by the NRA, and we saw a wide amount of Republicans, 90% by the president's count, go against it. And we also saw some senators from gun-heavy states that were Democrats move against it as well, including Mark Pryor and Senator Baucus from Montana. So it is interesting to see how this played out. This really was the best chance that a lot of gun control advocates could have. The assault weapons ban was the pie in the sky for a lot of these folks, but the consolation prize, or the very bare minimum that a lot of people were hoping for, were improved background checks. And, there's a lot of disappointment from a lot of progressives, as well as the president, who fired back today with one of his angrier statements, saying that this was a shameful day in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, you look at this and you go, okay, I thought this would have a shot of getting done. And for me, 54-46, that passes, except in today's Senate.
Exactly. This is the new normal in Washington, D.C., where you need a crazy supermajority to get anything done.
So I can't imagine what the dinner tonight with the Obama and the Democrats, especially the ones who voted against it, I can't imagine how that went.
That's a good question. And as Jeff Holtzman, one of our correspondents, pointed out, it does not look like there's going to be another dinner between Senate Republicans and the president anytime soon following a statement today.
Well, come on. I mean, how many times do you have to get kicked in the backside before you go, I got to give this up?
Well, this was supposed to be the post-election environment where the president was supposed to be more social and reaching across the aisle. But even if you do have a bipartisan piece of legislation supported by 90% of the population, politics still reign supreme, especially the anti-Obama side of politics.
Yeah. Did you see the story, Mark Sanford, the National Republican Party is going to walk away from Mark Sanford
down in South Carolina? This, of course, came after he faced allegations of trespassing on his ex-wife's property. And the main fear surrounding that was that there may be some more things that Mark Sanford has pulled that we are not yet aware of. So the National Republican Campaign Committee is sort of cutting him off. Which is pretty interesting. It's a relatively safe district, but nevertheless, Colbert Bush does seem to be moving up in the polls. She does seem to be pretty much evenly matched with the former governor. And, this financial support really could make or break his candidacy.
Yeah, and, the question I've got is, what are you doing with the ex-wife? I mean, what are you doing? Keep going into her house. And what's the Appalachian Trail woman thing?
That's a very good question. I don't believe he has responded to it yet. There has not been a comment last time I checked from the Sanford office. But it is characteristic with his, sneaking around habits that he has exhibited in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping he's elected. I got to be honest, because you got to love a good family values Republican in the House there who can stand on moral principle and point his finger with moral indignation with a clean heart and a good soul, right?
Well, you could definitely join the Foreign Affairs Committee. Waka waka.
There you go. And finally, the big decision today. I don't know. Were you at the Supreme Court? The big ruling today?
I was not at the Supreme Court today, no.
Evidently, now, no longer can, if you're arrested for suspicion of DUI, no longer can they forcefully take blood from you.
Interesting.
They used to be able to. They pull you in, take you to the thing, strap you down, they draw blood. Evidently not anymore. And surprisingly, Scalia was the fifth vote.
Huh. Well, I must have really been following that story, but that is nevertheless interesting. I'm not sure where I would fall on that, but that is, I guess, does have some civil rights implications and would be worth following up on.
Well, I mean, to me, it's that whole unreasonable search and seizure. I mean, they're jabbing you with a needle and they're extracting your blood. How much more invasive can you be? You know, how much more invasive can you need to be?
No, that's true, especially for, you know, I guess, you know, in a situation where a person would be innocent, that would be a grotesque violation of, you know, personal privacy, I would imagine.
Yeah, there you go. Justin, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Rick.
Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. Together we will live on forevermore. In the plan we have defended from all things dark and cold. Now we are defenseless.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Earth, sky.
Earth's human population has reached 7 billion and is projected to reach 9 billion by 2050. With this growing population, scientists say the depletion of groundwater is a serious issue. Most of the groundwater we use is to grow food.
Currently, about 90% of global freshwater resources is consumed by irrigated agriculture.
You're listening to Bridget Scanlon, senior research scientist at the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas. She told us that the highest area of irrigated agriculture is in India, followed by China, and then the U.S. Scanlon said water shortages are most likely to occur where irrigation is most widespread. But, she said, our human demands are putting stress on aquifers around the globe.
The health of the aquifer depends on how much water is going back into the aquifer from rainfall and recharge versus how much water you are pumping out of the aquifer for irrigation.
And we're using water from many of Earth's aquifers faster than they can fill back up, Scanlon said. We asked her what sorts of things can be done to solve the problem of accelerating depletion of groundwater.
I think an obvious thing would be to reduce irrigated agriculture, convert irrigated agriculture to rain-fed agriculture.
Today's show was made possible in part by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight. The Rick Smith Show.
So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Leave it up to Pat Buchanan. You gotta love crazy Pat Buchanan. And he's really gone further and further off the deep end as the years have gone on. There was a point where, you know, when he was running for president at one point, I think it was back in 88, or maybe it was 92 when he was running, talking about, you know, we can't be, you know, these insane free trade agreements. You know, we can't be doing all of this globalization. I agreed with that. All the other crazy stuff, not so much. But he was on Fox News, and again, you know, I guess he had written a piece for Fox News and for World Net Daily, where he comes out and he says, you know, with this the gay rights stuff, you know, all these gay people who want equality, he said, we need a new era of civil disobedience against them. And you go, really? I mean, is this? And he's calling on the, and this is what gets me. This is what kind of confuses me about the call from the religious right. Pat Buchanan is saying, look, the priests and the pastors, you need people who are going to say, get on the pulpit and say, we're not going to take it. We're going to, it's immoral and you know, we need laws and this is God's country and you know, basically inciting these right-wing hate mongers to impose their views and their values on all the rest of us. Look, I don't care who you marry. I don't. As long as you're a decent, honest person, you pay your taxes. It's that old theory, you know, do unto others, man. And I look at Buchanan and I go, explain this to me because I'm missing something. He says the culture war in America today may be seen as squabbles in daycare centers compared to what is coming. A new era of civil disobedience may be at hand because they're going to rise up and take people's rights away. Remember, the rights endowed by your Creator. Equal opportunity under the law. Remember the Constitution. Yeah, I mean, to me, it's very clear. I don't know how you can stand on and say, I believe in the Constitution, and then pursue discriminatory activities. I guess I just don't get it. Good news, as I said in the last segment, the National Republicans have walked away from former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford. Seems Mark has, you know, been visiting the ex on occasion, just walking into the house, I guess. You know, thought it was his. As part of this, the divorce settlement. And you go, why, and I asked this last night, why in the name of sanity would you be going anywhere near your ex-wife? I mean, their children are grown. Why get yourself in this? Especially when you know that you're running for U.S. Congress. Now, he's going to have to appear in court 2 days after the election. The election is May 7th, May 9th. He'll be in court. Maybe they'll lock him up. Maybe he can't go after all. And I look at this and I go, you know, what does the Republican Party know about Mr. Sanford and his exploits? And look, I think we should make a reality series out of the Appalachian Trail. Make a reality series out of it. What I find interesting is that what would have been funny to see Jenny Sanford run against him. That would have been the better race, other than instead of Colbert Bush, who's Stephen Colbert's sister. It would have been true reality TV to see a divorced couple running for Congress against each other. Can you imagine the mudslinging? That would take it to a whole nother level. And as you know, they are running for the seat left open by Tim Scott, who was appointed to the Senate. So it will be interesting to see where this goes. And I'm glad to see that the Republicans have pulled all of their money because, well, we don't know what else he's done. And, you know, I want to see the good God-fearing Christian Appalachian Trail guy. I want to see him there. What worse could happen? Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go. Podcast, also Stitcher. Take that on the go with you. You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Ideas, questions, comments. If you want information about our bus tour, we're looking to... again, June 8th through July 5th, we're going to be doing our bus tour out to San Jose for Netroots Nation. We're going to finish up somewhere in Pittsburgh on July 4th for our wrap-up. We'll be traveling to cities all across the country doing our program and doing some other projects that we're looking forward to. So if you've got ideas, questions, comments, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial.